Welcome and peace be unto you. We welcome you to Cal State University Domingo Hills, coming live to you from the Cal State University Domingo Hills, live on DHTV, as well as from on the internet worldwide. We are discussing today the religious violence and the Quran. This is a topic that has been much center of debate and discussion, specifically in recent weeks. Many people have questioned whether scripture mesh with modern sensibilities. Some question, are scriptures politically correct? Of course, when looked in that light, we find there is plenty of political incorrectness to be found in virtually all scripture. The question of the Quran and religious violence in particular has been the center of much debate and discussion, specifically since September the 11th. Some people have tried to use, abuse, construe or misconstrue Quranic verses as if to indicate that it justifies violence against people of different faiths. On the other hand, there have been those not of the Muslim faith who have tried to create an impression that the Quran in itself is inherently a violent text or a text that promotes violence, and Islam therefore a religion founded on violence. So today we will discuss the Quran and violence. First of all, it's important for us to understand what is the Quran, at least to those who believe in it as sacred scripture. According to the Muslims, and according to Islamic ideology and philosophy and way of life, all this is based on a primary text which is considered the final revelation of God, which is the Holy Quran. The historical personality and identity of the Ummah, which is the global community of faith, global community of believers, global community of those who prescribe to the Islamic religion and ideology. The historic personality and identity of this Ummah emanates from and is fashioned by its holy book, which is the Quran. Prophet Muhammad, who was the last of a line of messengers who came throughout history, starting with Adam, was not only the recipient of the final revelation, but according to Muslim belief, being the final prophet, also its most authentic expounder. The Quran is considered a book of guidance, addressing by and large the totality of humanity. As scripture, the distinctive feature of the Quran lies in its embodiment of the final most divine communique, seeking to reach every level of human understanding through similitudes, parables, reasoning, and hearkening towards observing natural phenomena and harmonizing with natural law. Muslims believe, and linguists concur, that though the Quran is clothed in human language, it is the ethical code and considered by Muslims a primary source of divine law expressed in the best of classical Arabic. While interpreting the Quran, one highlights the rationale and wisdom of certain aspects of the divine text with an effort to convey the relevance of the Quranic message to contemporary issues. In this way, tafsir literature, or literature regarding the interpretation or pertaining to the interpretation of the Quran, reflects Muslim thought and academism at its best, for it captures the richness, originality, and variety of Islamic contribution to human thought and to civilization in general. Every period and every era has had its outstanding contributors, testifying to the inner strength, vitality, and relevance of the Quranic come Islamic tradition. However, serious intellectual effort is demanded to respond to the challenging qualitative changes in the contemporary world, and the essential human factor is required in comprehending, interpreting, and construing from divine guidance and from the divine text the most appropriate response for the times. Neither rhetoric nor emotionalism can replace this intellectual responsibility. The Quran, according to Muslims, is the word of God. And God, or Allah, is divine and perfect. Tafsir, or interpretation, or understanding of the text, is human understanding. And human beings are neither divine nor perfect. It is the responsibility of the educated and discerning listener and observer and reader to note that distinction between interpretation of text and the context of the text itself and the content of the text. The second question that we need to look at, besides the scope of the Quran in Muslim life, is to analyze violence in itself. If the topic be Quran and religious violence, or the Quran and violence, how do we define violence? Professor Sayyid Hossein Nasser, one of the great contemporary Islamic scholars, has said in an article, Islam and the Question of Violence, despite the presence of violence in many regions of the world, ranging from Ireland to Lebanon to the Pacific Basin, and involving many religions from Christianity to Hinduism, the Western world associates Islam more than any other religion with violence. Upheavals of the past few decades in the Middle East, and especially movements using the name of Islam and seeking to solve problems of the Muslim world, created by conditions and causes beyond their control, have only reinforced the idea prevalent in the West that in some special way Islam is related to violence. To understand the nature of Islam and the truth about the assertion often made of Islam and its espousal of violence, it is important to analyze this question, clearly remembering that the word Islam means peace and that the history of Islam has certainly not been witness to any more violence than one finds in any other civilizations, particularly that of the West. It is necessary for us then to define what we mean by violence. And there are several dictionary definitions of what violence is. Rough, injurious, physical force or action, unjust or unwarranted exertion of force, especially against the rights of others. If these words and these terms are the definitions for violence, then the question can be asked as to how Islam is related to these definitions. As far as force is concerned, Islam is not completely opposed to the use of force, but rather seeks to control it in the light of the divine law, interpreted by human understanding, manifested as Sharia. This world is one in which force is to be found everywhere, in nature as well as in human society, among men as well as within the human soul. The goal of Islam is to establish an equilibrium amidst this field of tension of variation of forces. The Islamic concept of justice itself is related to the idea of equilibrium. The word for justice, adl, in Arabic, is directly related in its etymology to the word for equilibrium, which is ta'adul. All forces under the guidance of the divine law with the aim of re-establishing an equilibrium that is destroyed is accepted and in fact necessary. For it means to carry out and establish justice and the balance. By embracing the world and not shunning the kingdom of Caesar, Islam took upon itself the responsibility for the world in which force is present. Peace is not accidental, but the result of the control of force, with the aim of establishing that harmony which results from an equilibrium of forces, whether those forces be natural, social, or psychological. As for the meaning of violence as rough or injurious physical force or action, Islamic law opposes all use of force in this sense, except in the case of war or for punishment of criminals in accordance with the law. The third question which we have to look at is the Quranic text and its historical context. Because a text is always revealed in a particular context. It needs to be understood in its original context before it could be applied in any other later context. So the contextualization of the text is very significant. In an article written by Karen Armstrong, the historian and the famous writer, an article on "Is Islam Violent?" she says, and I quote, "What does the Quran say about violence? The word Islam, which means surrender, is related to the Arabic term salam or peace. When Prophet Muhammad brought the revealed scripture called the Quran to the Arabs in the early 7th century, one of the main purposes was precisely to stop the kind of indiscriminate killings that we saw on September the 11th. At the time, the Arabian Peninsula was in crisis. The tribal system was breaking down, and the various tribes were locked into a murderous cycle of vendetta and counter-vendetta. For a weak tribe or a person who lacked powerful protection, survival was nearly impossible. The Prophet himself suffered several assassination attempts, and when his religious and social message ran him afoul of the establishment of Mecca, the small Muslim community was persecuted. Things got so bad that the Muslims had to migrate to Medina, some 250 miles to the north, and there they were subject to attack by the Meccan army, which was the greatest power in Arabia at that time." War is not the objective in Islam, nor in the Quranic text. Nor is it a normal cause for Muslims. It is only the last resort and is used under the most extraordinary circumstances when all other measures have failed. The Quran itself makes it clear that it is a necessity of existence, a fact of life. So long as there exists in the world injustice, oppression, there will be war. And that is why Islam has recognized war as a lawful and justifiable cause for self-defense and restoration of justice, restoration of freedom and of peace. The Quran says in chapter 2, verse 216, "Fighting is prescribed for you and you dislike it. But it is possible that you dislike a thing which is good for you and that you love a thing which is bad for you. God knows and you know not." And in another verse, in chapter 2, verse 251, "And if God did not check one set of people by means of another, the earth would indeed be full of mischief and corruption." Although realistic in its approach, Islam never tolerates aggression from its own side or from any other side. Nor does it enter aggressive wars or promotes the initiation of aggressive wars. Muslims are commanded by God not to begin hostilities, nor to embark on any act of aggression, nor to violate any rights of others. The Quran says in chapter 5, "Fight in the cause of God those who fight you, and do not transgress the limits, for God does not love those who are transgressors." The early experience of Arabia taught the early Muslim community that it is more effective to be peaceful when you are strong enough to guard your peace, that your voice of peace would echo better when you are able to resist pressure and eliminate oppression. Again, we look at Karen Armstrong and I quote what she said. "The only war condoned by the Quran is a war of self-defense. Warfare is an awesome evil, but sometimes it is necessary to fight in order to bring the kind of persecution suffered to an end, or to preserve decent values. But Muslims may never initiate hostilities, and aggression is forbidden by God. While the fighting continues, Muslims must dedicate themselves wholly to the war in order to bring back to normal as quickly as possible. But as soon as the enemy inclines to peace, hostilities must cease." This is a quote from Karen Armstrong. "Is Islam violent? Is the Quran violent?" Unquote. From Karen Armstrong. This begs the question. In this week, Pat Robertson, the head of the Christian Coalition, said something about the Quran and about Islam, challenging President Bush's statement that Islam is a peaceful religion. And there has been a great outcry and response to what he has said. I would like to play a snippet from CNN, the interview with Pat Robertson, and look at that as how the Quran is misunderstood, and then respond to some of the issues which are very commonly felt by many people who are not very well informed about the Quranic text or about Islam. Let's take a look.
11th, President Bush has repeatedly stressed that the war on terrorism is not one against Islam, and that in his view, the Muslim religion is a peaceful one. But recently, the Reverend Pat Robertson derided Islam, sparking criticism from both Muslim and Christian groups. Joining us now to discuss this from Virginia Beach is Pat Robertson. Sir, welcome to Late Edition.
Thanks, John.
Let's start. Go ahead, sir.
I wanted to start, if I could, with a little bit of my bona fides on this one. We've run an Arabic language television station in the Middle East for about 16 years. It was overrun by Hezbollah and blown up. And I've met a couple of times with Yasser Arafat. I gave the Prince of Peace Award to Anwar Sadat in the Blair House. And we have many, many friends all over the Arab world, so I'm very familiar with Islam. We have Arabic-speaking people here on our staff, and that was the source of some of my comments.
Okay, let's review your comment for our viewers, and then get you to explain just what you meant, sir. This is what you said Thursday on your show, The 700 Club. I have taken issue with our esteemed president in regard to his stand in saying Islam is a peaceful religion. It's just not. And the Quran makes it very clear. If you see an infidel, you are to kill him. That's what it says. Now, that doesn't sound very peaceful to me. You believe the faith overall, the Muslim faith, is a violent faith.
John, I looked up the Encyclopedia Britannica to prepare for this interview, and I looked up two words, tours, battle of, and also jihad. And the encyclopedia says this, and it's very, very clear, believers are under obligation to wage war against all unbelievers. That's the Encyclopedia Britannica. The Battle of Tours, you remember, in 732, repulsed the so-called Muslim hordes who were coming in to overrun Europe. And they swept on jihad for about 100 years. And Muhammad said the second most important duty follower of Islam is to wage jihad against the infidels. I mean, it's very clear in the Quran and in his writing and in his words what he intended.
Now, I want to make clear that you're certainly not the only Christian minister to make this point, and I want to show a quotation from Franklin Graham back in October. Dr. Graham wrote, "I don't believe this is this wonderful, peaceful religion. When you read the Quran and you read the verses from the Quran, it instructs the killing of the infidel for those that are non-Muslim." So Reverend Graham makes the same point you make, Reverend Robertson. I guess my question is, if you believe that, is it then, do you feel an obligation then to preach that message publicly, or do you think and do you worry that perhaps, because we are at a time when perhaps some prejudices have been stoked by the events of September 11th, that it would be best off if you turned the other cheek, said nothing?
Well, it's not a question of saying nothing. I think people ought to be aware of what we're dealing with. There are many, many people in the Islamic world who don't have a clue what the Quran says. They're sort of fellow travelers, so to speak. They're wonderful, lovely people, and I have many friends. The same thing is true in America. They don't really hold to the teachings of Muhammad, but the Quran says the essential part of Islam is that, A, you would make Allah the one true God, and Muhammad is his only prophet. And if he is the only prophet, then what he said is taken literally by hundreds of millions of the radical, and the Muslim population around the world has been radicalized, and Osama bin Laden, whether we like it or not, is a hero to the street people over there.
Your comment has stoked a bit of a political controversy. I want to quote to you from an editorial in the Washington Post, this editorial in the Post just yesterday. Is Mr. Robertson trying to start a pogrom? If so, he's headed in the right direction. These sorts of words aren't innocent talk, particularly not when broadcast into millions of homes by a religious leader to whom many look for moral guidance. How do you make the judgment, sir? You know you have a large audience. You know you are influential among conservative Christians and across this country. How do you make the judgment that you want to say something like that? And do you worry, again, that it could incite some prejudice?
Listen, it's not a question of prejudice. The World Trade Center was blown up, and so was the Pentagon. We have thousands and perhaps hundreds and thousands and millions of people who hate America and are trying to destroy Israel. And something has been unleashed in the world, which is a terrible evil, and it's aimed at the United States, and it's aimed at Israel, and it's especially aimed at Jews and Christians. And for me not to tell our audience that this is the belief of these people is wrong. Now, sure, in America, many, many so-called Muslims have watered down the teachings of Muhammad. They say, well, we don't believe that. We don't believe the Quran. Really, it's something else. But if you believe what those people in Mecca believe, what the people who follow Osama bin Laden believe, then we have an enemy we have to do something about. And it's like Paul Revere. Was he trying to stir up prejudice when he said the British are coming? I mean, it's we need an alarm because this country's under attack.
Pat Robertson, the head of a Christian coalition and a person who ran for president, for the office of president of this country. Now, just to respond to some of the issues, first of all, we need to understand that he begins by making reference to the Hezbollah blowing up the offices of the Christian coalition. What has that got to do with Quran and violence in the first place? I'm from South Africa, and the Dutch Reformed Church in South Africa endorsed apartheid, supported apartheid. It was a major church in South Africa. No one blames the whole of Christianity for that, and it was an official church. The Dutch Reformed Church is a well-known church, known in our country, in South Africa, as the Nederlandse Gereformeerde Kerk. An entire church, not a group or a fringe organization. Secondly, people in his office are familiar with the Arabic. What does that mean? People are familiar with the Arabic. If people are familiar with Hebrew, does it mean they know the Bible or with Aramaic? Or if they are familiar with English, they know Shakespeare? Thirdly, Arabic-speaking people. Just because people are Arabic speaking does not know that they know what's in the Quran. Thirdly, defining jihad as a holy war against infidels by the Encyclopedia Britannica. Why not use the Quran? First of all, check very carefully what Encyclopedia Britannica says. And it's quite a large and lengthy section on jihad, by the way. Why do we choose a particular section and then to don't quote exactly what it says? And secondly, why not quote in a Quranic source, an Islamic source itself? Why use another source as to what jihad is? And we will deal with that. Jihad is a second pillar of Islam. Jihad has never been a pillar of Islam. We've dealt with the five pillars. Testimony to faith and believing in all the prophets, by the way, and believing that Muhammad is the last of the prophets. Prayer five times a day. Giving charity, zakah. The social welfare tax, obligatory upon those who are able to give. Fasting in the month of Ramadan for those who are able to fast. And pilgrimage once in a lifetime for those who are able to do so. Pillars of faith. When did jihad become a second pillar of faith? Then Prophet Muhammad is the only prophet. There is a finality of prophet. Quran believes in Moses, Jesus, Abraham, Lot, Jacob, John the Baptist. All these are prophets of God. Muhammad was only the final one of these prophets. He was not the only one. No Muslim of any sect, of any group, any time in history, with all the difference of opinion, have ever indicated that Muhammad was the only prophet in Islam. In fact, it is a blasphemy. It is considered un-Islamic to consider only one prophet and not others. In chapter 4 of the Quran, there's a reference that whosoever believes in some prophets and denies the others is an unbeliever. So if I say I believe in Muhammad and reject Jesus or Moses, automatically I become an unbeliever, according to Muslims. So this is gross ignorance, and it's unfortunate that this has come across in this way. And then that Muslims do not know what the Quran says. Who has done this survey? And what do people in Mecca believe? What do the people in Mecca believe? It's so problematic. And to think that people of this nature have been in a position or were in a position to run for the highest office in this great country, it is really questionable. It raises a lot of questions. It raises a lot of questions. It may reinforce some of the stereotyping on the other side, which is very, very unfortunate. Believe that Allah is the only God. Well, the Christians, Jews, and Muslims believe in the same God. The Arabs themselves, who speak Arabic, refer to God as Allah. It's not a Muslim God or a particular God for any particular people. Allah is the Arabic name for the divine being. And even if he has Christian staff, as he says he has, who speak Arabic, ask them what they call God in their language when they pray. They refer to him as God, which is Allah in Arabic. And Allah is the term used. So to indicate even that Prophet Muhammad is the only messenger, that the Encyclopedia Britannica says something about the Quran, and that people of this nature have an access. And good luck to them. May God bless them for the good they do. But to have this kind of access, and for people of faith to be misinformed by people who proclaim to be people of faith, this is really a sad thing. Let us look at the essential Quran. And there are 7 points that I will bring out, what I refer to as the essential Quran. And this is somewhat a relationship between Muslims and others, whether they be Muslim or non-Muslim. The first thing, and I will give the references as well, point number one is that life is sacred. This is manifested in the Quran on numerous occasions. Chapter 5, verse 32, chapter 6, verse 158, chapter 17, verse 33. One of them says, if anyone kills a person, not in retaliation for murder, nor to spread mischief in the land, it would be as if he has killed the entire humanity. And whosoever saves a single life in the estimation of God has saved the entire humanity. That's chapter 5, verse 32. You shall not kill any person, for God has made life sacred, except in the cause of justice. Chapter 17, verse 33. Second point is, overcoming evil with good. There's an exhortation in the Quran all the time. The primary purpose of people of faith in their interaction as social beings is to manifest goodness and excellence, ihsan and itqan. And this entire philosophy of Muslim thought and practice is captured in this term ihsan, literally meaning goodness, but in reality implying a degree of God consciousness. That each individual is individually to be held accountable for his or her deeds. Being aware that God is witnessing what they are doing and that they'll be retributed, punished or rewarded for the good or evil they do. And therefore the Quran says, overcome evil with goodness. Overcome evil with goodness. The third point which I wish to bring to our attention is an exhortation for Muslims never to be destructive nor malicious. This is the third point. Never be destructive nor malicious. And the Quran said, do not destroy one another. For behold, Allah is indeed a dispenser of grace unto you. And as for those who destroy with malicious intent and a will and an inclination to do wrong, we in time shall cause them to endure the punishment of the hellfire in the hereafter. For this is indeed easy for God. The fourth point is befriending those who do not fight you. If there are Muslims or people of any faith who are at war with anybody else because of the other faith, that is purely because of intolerance and bigotry. It's not an injunction in Islam that you be at war with those who are at peace with you. And therefore, we find the Quran very clearly says, God does not forbid you. This is chapter 60, verse 8. God does not forbid you from befriending those who do not fight you. This is the fourth point. Befriending those who do not fight you. Chapter 60, verse 8. God does not forbid you from befriending those who do not fight you because of your faith. Nor do they evict you from your homes because of your faith. You may befriend them and be equitable towards them, for God loves those who are equitable. The fifth point is, do not be aggressive. The idea that Islam is aggressive or Muslims are somewhat very cool and calm and there's a streak of aggression in them that surfaces at the appropriate time, and this causes a tremendous amount of suspicion of people who may be Muslim. Quran makes it very clear in numerous places, and we have two references here, and do not aggress, for God does not love those who are aggressors. And in the other one, fight in the way of God those who fight against you. Fight in the way of God those who fight against you, but do not transgress. God does not love those who transgress. The sixth point, advocating compassion and tolerance. You shall resort to pardon, advocate tolerance, and disregard the ignorant. Resort to pardon is a command from God. Advocate tolerance and disregard the ignorant. The seventh point, there shall be no compulsion in religion. You can't compel people to faith. What kind of faith, what kind of commitment would that be if people are compelled to faith? Yes, throughout history, people have been, have used and abused faith. People have been attacked in the name of faith. And as we have said before, it's unfortunate that so many people are prepared to kill in the name of religion and so few are prepared to live by its principles. There shall be no compulsion in religion. Even in the propagation of Islam, it is forbidden to employ force, but we are also commanded at the same time to use the most peaceful methods. And God says, invite to the way of your Lord with wisdom and beautiful preaching, and argue with those who differ with you in the best and most gracious manner. For your Lord knows best those who are on the path and those who receive guidance from those who don't. Another chapter 29, verse 46. And dispute not with the people of the book, Jews and Christians, except with means that are best. But say, we believe in the revelation which has come down to us and the revelation which has come down to you. For our God and your God is but one God, and it is to Him that we submit. From these texts, it's very, very clear that the entire context and the text of the Holy Quran, the essential Quran, the fundamentals of the faith, the exhortations regarding the social nature of the human being, is to acknowledge these seven principles. Life as sacred, to overcome evil with goodness, not to be destructive nor malicious. There's no harm in befriending those who befriend you and not to fight those who befriend you. Not to be aggressive, advocating compassion and tolerance, and not compelling other people towards your religion. The question then is asked, what about the term jihad, which Pat Robinson referred to as the second pillar of Islam, which it is not? The word jihad is much misunderstood, as Karen Armstrong says in her article, Is Islam Violent? The word jihad is much misunderstood. It is rarely used as a noun in the Quran, but in a verbal form, meaning striving, struggling, or exerting an effort. Now, we have heard the comments of Pat Robertson, and if there are any of those of you who agree with that kind of view and who wish to raise some of those kind of issues, you're more than welcome to call in. And anybody else who wish to contribute to the program, welcome to call in and comment or ask a question. Please feel free to do so. Now, regarding jihad itself, grave misconceptions prevail regarding jihad, while a plethora of misinformation create fear and prejudice in the minds of the unsuspecting. Equating jihad with war is to undermine the reality and to limit the noble purpose of jihad itself. As regards the term holy war, which in Arabic translates as harbul muqaddas, a term not found in Quranic tradition, in Quranic text, nor in prophetic tradition, the term holy war, harbul muqaddas, is not jihad. And it's, the word jihad itself, of course, is derived from the root word jahada, which implies effort, endeavor, exerting oneself, or the striving for excellence. It is of utmost importance to consider the sense in which the term is used in the sacred text. To negate the false notion that jihad is inherently brutal and bloody, we make reference to this term in the very early revelations received by Prophet Muhammad while he was in Mecca, and certainly at that time in no position whatsoever to take up arms. And amongst the earliest revelations defining jihad, chapter 29, verse 69, and chapter 29, verse 6, where the word jihad is freely used in the sense of striving for excellence and moral elevation without in any way implying war. The word jihad is used precisely in the same sense on two occasions in chapter 29, verse 6. Now, a study of the Quranic text would indicate that jihad is of different categories. The first form of jihad, and perhaps the highest form of jihad according to some scholars, implies the fighting or struggling against one's baser animal self, and hence the fight against the internal evils of desire, of greed, of ego, of selfishness, and of envy. This is evidenced from a statement which Prophet Muhammad is said to have made, and some scholars differ regarding the degree of authenticity of the exact statement, but nonetheless, when the Muslims returned from a battle where they were under attack from the Meccans while they were living in Medina, he said, "You have now returned from the minor struggle and now for the major one, which is the struggle against the self." And the word jihad is said to have been used there. A second level is to strive to meet one's social and moral responsibilities. In a well-known tradition, in a very well-authenticated tradition, Prophet Muhammad responded to a young man who requested permission to join in a physical battle where the Muslims were under attack and they were outnumbered 3-1. He requested to join the army, and due to the fact that he was a teenager under the age of 16 and could therefore not go onto the battlefield, he was asked, "Are your parents alive?" To which the young man responded in the affirmative. And the Prophet said, "Take care of your parents, for that is your jihad. That is your struggle. That is your striving." Another kind of jihad is to fight in self-defense. And of course, there are numerous other intermediate to studying in the, treading in the path of learning, going out seeking knowledge, pursuing the truth. Those who leave home to study, to pursue higher studies, these are also termed jihad. The Prophet has referred to this. Whosoever goes out in the path of learning, he's in the path of God until he returns. And if he dies in the pursuit of knowledge, he dies a martyr. Those are the terms you need to understand, how the word martyrdom is used, how the word jihad is used in the original context. Now, as regards fighting, is there an element of jihad or a level of jihad which does include physical fighting? Yes, there is. And the word used for that kind of engaging is called qital. Now, the first verse in the Quran which granted permission, remember the Quran was revealed over a period of 23 years. The text was revealed in a particular context. And those who know anything whatsoever about the Quran will understand and do know this, whether they be Muslim or not, that there's an entire science of what they call asbabun nuzul, the purpose and place of revelation, why a particular verse was revealed and in response to what particular incident. And then look at how those particular injunctions or that revelation, whether it is specific to that incident or whether it is a general principle to be applied to all periods, to all people, under all circumstances. The essential Quran which I referred to, those seven indicators, are very clearly agreed upon by scholars as being the basic underlying essential structure of human relationship which the Quran endorses. When it comes to being under attack, when it becomes to be the victims of oppression or injustice, specific commands are given. And some of these verses were revealed in a specific circumstances for a specific incident or in response to a particular issue. We need to understand that. But however, the first verse which was revealed, which gave Muslims the permission to fight, and I'll read the entire verse for you to understand. Because this is the first verse revealed which gave permission to fight. And Muslims were now in power in Medina. They had an army. They were under attack nonetheless, but the point was that they now had an army to defend themselves, unlike in Mecca, which they didn't have. And look at the first permission to fight. And I read the verse exactly, and you can check it up. Chapter 22, verses 39 to 41. It says, surely Allah defends those who have faith, and Allah does not love those who are ungrateful and perfidious. Permission to fight is now granted to those against whom war is made, because they have been wronged. And Allah indeed has the power to help them. For they are those who are driven from their homes unjustly due to their faith. If Allah did not repel some people by means of others, they surely would have been destroyed. Many monasteries, churches, synagogues and mosques, wherein the name of the Almighty is often commemorated. Surely Allah will help those who help His cause, for He is indeed powerful and mighty. Now this extract, chapter 22, verse 39 to 40, is the first verse by unanimous agreement of all scholars, of all schools of thought, that this was the first injunction giving permission to Muslims to take up arms, that part of jihad, the qital, the fighting against aggression. Now, this, it gives an idea as to when, how, and for what reason arms could and should be taken up. Now, how could jihad imply killing people of other faith? How could jihad in itself, by its very definition, be associated with the killing of anybody who is an unbeliever, when the first verse giving permission to fight specifically exhorts the Muslim to fight in order to defend those who have been oppressed because of their religion, because they've been driven from their homes without just cause, and to defend places of worship, and it mentions by name monasteries, churches, mosques, and synagogues. By the way, there were no known churches in Medina at that time. The next point I wish to bring to our attention is that some critics make reference to a part of a verse in chapter 2, verse 192, which reads, and kill them wherever you find them, and drive them out from wherever they have driven you out. And this verse has so often been quoted, and even in the article that I have made reference to earlier on, in the article, it sounds like hate, but is it? A wonderful article by Teresa Watanabe of the LA Times, which appeared last week. But even here she quotes that the Quran says, kill the infidels. And I make reference to that verse in particular here. You see, when reading the verse and the preceding verse and the verses that follow it, it is absolutely clear that reference is made to those combatants who have engaged the Muslims in war, those who have perpetrated injustice against the believers or the populace. And this verse in no way is a blanket injunction or approval for any Muslim to willfully attack any non-Muslim because of their faith. Let me read the verses. Chapter 2, verse 190 to verse 194. Fight against those who fight against you. This is the problem, that people don't refer to the text. Read the entire text, the preceding verse and the verse thereafter. There's no verse in the Quran that says, kill the unbelievers, just by itself. Fight against those who fight against you in the way of Allah, but do not transgress, for Allah does not love transgressors. Kill them wherever you find them, and drive them out from where they drove you out. Kill whom? Those who fight against you. Not those who are not fighting against you. So it's in a specific context. That fight those who are fighting you, and kill them if you have to kill them, and drive them out, not of their homes. Drive them out from where they drove you out. Nowhere in the Quran does it say drive them out. It says drive them out from where they have driven you out. Because wrongful persecution is worse than killing. And it goes on, if they desist, chapter 2 verse 192, if they cease their hostility, know well that Allah is ever forgiving, most compassionate. Keep on fighting against them until mischief ends and the way prescribed by God prevails. But if they cease their hostility, in other words, if it's a continuous fight, you fight them till the end, till the law of God is established. But if they cease hostility, then know that you should cease hostility. And hostility should only be against those who are oppressors. And the last verse in that series, if someone has attacked you, attack him or respond to the attack as he has attacked you. And fear Allah. Do not transgress. Be conscious that Allah is with those who guard against transgressing and violating the bounds which He has set. We have callers on the line. We have lights flashing. We'll take the first caller. Please go ahead, state your name and your question or comment, sir. Or lady.
Hello, hi. My name is Ben. I'm calling from West LA.
Welcome, Ben.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
The question is, I'm a Baha'i. I don't know if you heard of Baha'i.
Yes, I have heard.
And we've been persecuted in Iran for many, many years.
All right.
A lot of Baha'is have been killed, executed. They've been denied jobs. They can't get a job in government. They can't get a job in anywhere in the country. And I just want to know, what's your feeling about Baha'i faith and why these poor people in Iran for past 134 years have been prosecuted like that by Muslims?
Yes, even 34 years, you say?
100 plus years, yes.
Okay, fine. I think that first of all, I cannot speak on behalf of the Iranian government. That question should be posed to them. First of all, I believe that people have the right. I'm not a member of the Baha'i faith myself, though I'm familiar with the Baha'i faith, of course. It was considered originally an offshoot from Shiite Islam and to the Shaykhi sect, and eventually the Bab and then the Baha'u'llah, of course. And it was seen as a breakaway from Islam, and of course there was some tension from the outset. And of course, you always know when there's an offshoot from any religion, there's always that kind of tension.
Right.
Now, I'm not a Baha'i, and I don't prescribe to the Baha'i faith, and you're welcome to be whatever you want to be, and I respect you for that.
Yeah.
Why you are being persecuted in Iran in itself, that is a question that should be addressed to the Iranian government. I don't think it's proper for anyone to be persecuted because of their faith. If they're doing so, they could do it in the name of religion, but it's not necessarily what religion prescribes.
So,
because they're not the only ones being persecuted, by the way. There are many people in many parts of the world persecuted under the name of religion, whether Islam or Christianity or Judaism, under the guise of religion, but not necessarily prescribed by the religion.
Okay.
So I wish that there would not be any persecution. If people are criminals or they've been involved in injustice or prompting or propping up unjust governments or oppressive regimes, if they were supporting the Shah at the time of oppression, for example, that's a different story. But if they're innocent people living there, whether they be Baha'i or atheist or Christian or Jew, they should not be persecuted.
The oppression started about many years ago, even before the Shah, when many older regimes were there.
Yes.
And Baha'i, by being Baha'i, they've been persecuted.
Yes. So, I mean, the point, it was not the only Islamic thing that means, because the governments before that were not necessarily Islamic. But the point is that there was persecution nonetheless.
Right.
And this is because of prejudice, I suppose, brother.
No, my point is, because of being an Islamic country, that's why they were being under persecution. Because, Iran is an Islamic country.
It's an Islamic
country. No matter if the Shah is there or other regimes are there.
Yes.
And that's why these poor people, for many, many years, they've been persecuted. Because of Islam. In the name of Allah, as you know.
if you claim the Shah to have been of an Islamic government, I think many people will disagree with you. I know in the last 30 years, since the revolution in 79, people would call it an Islamic country or an Islamic government. But prior to that, I don't know if they would say Islamic government. So it's unfortunate that you have been under persecution by whoever was in charge, and not necessarily because of Islam, but maybe they were Muslims.
Right.
Maybe they were Christians or Jews or
anybody
else in charge. But the point is, still remains, no innocent person,
right,
whether Baha'i or otherwise, I mean, this is the point you are making, and I echo your sentiments, should be persecuted because of their faith.
Yeah.
If a person is a criminal or a
because
wrongdoer,
Quran never
prove the case.
That, right.
Yes, Ben?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you for calling
again.
We have another caller on the line.
Thanks again. Bye.
Please go ahead, state your name and your question or comment, please. Joe, from North Hollywood.
I can hardly hear you.
I can hear you very well, Joe.
Okay, I had just a question. It has nothing to do with it. But I just want to know if in the Quran it states how many wives you're supposed to have, and does Allah want us to have many wives? Or that's a question.
Allah wanted many wives? What is the question, Joe?
Does Allah want us to have many wives?
Does He will us to have many wives?
Is it like something, is it a cultural thing, or is it in the Quran stating...
The number of wives, you mean, Joe? Is the number of wives?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what I want to know.
Yeah. Again, thank you very much for the question, Joe. Though it's not related to the topic, but I'll respond to that. Of course, the Quran in chapter 4 makes reference, very early in chapter 4, makes reference to trying to undo or rectify social injustices. And the reference in the Quran is to cater for the orphans, for the needy, for the destitute. And then in that particular verse it mentions, and marry women 2, 3, or 4 in that context. And if you find that you cannot deal justly with more than one, then only one, by the way. So marrying more than one wife, and I will deal with this issue sometime later in my series, which will deal with misconceptions about Islam, the whole issue about women and so on and so forth. I will be dealing with that, though this is another topic. But thank you, Joe. I just answered that question, I think, because Joe mentioned it and it came across through the line, that the Quran does not exhort us, nor does it recommend four wives. In a society like the Arab society where Prophet Muhammad lived, where there was no limitation on the number of wives, a person could have hundreds of wives, and even a son would inherit his father's wives besides his own biological mother, he could inherit all his stepmothers. In that society, the marriage was limited, was a limitation that you could marry up to four wives. And it's not a recommended thing, by the way. It is recommended that you should not have 100, but it didn't recommend that you should have 4. It limited the amount up to 4. And in the time of warfare and so on and so forth, when you find that there are women who are widows, and the Quranic verse, if you look at it, chapter 4, verses 2, 3, and 4. Check up those verses. Chapter 4, which is, the chapter is called An-Nisa, it means the women. The chapter is titled The Women, and you will find what it refers to. And the Quran does not encourage marrying more than one wife, though some of the chauvinists, and of course some males, people always interpret how they wish to interpret it. The Quran doesn't encourage it, nor does it exhort it, nor does Allah wish us to have more than one wife. Having more than one wife implies having more than one mother-in-law. So there's a lot of responsibility with that. But no, the Quran does not exhort us to have more than one wife. It recommends one. It prescribes one under certain circumstances where there is a problem, where maybe, for example, you find that there are many women after war and so on and so forth, and the women want to marry, they're welcome. And the limitation was set to 4. That verse was not a prescription to 4 wives, a limitation from an unlimited amount to 4 at a maximum. It was a limitation rather than a prescription of having 4 wives. But the prescription is still 1, not 4 itself. Now, having made reference to those chapter 2, verse 191, so often quoted that, you know, kill the infidels, and I've given it to you in context, please check it up. Chapter 2, verse 190 to 194. I've heard at least 17 to 18 radio and despicably radio programs and some television programs making reference to it. But in television and radio programs, quite a few references. The Quran says in chapter 2, kill them, verse 190 or so. And they don't go further into the context of the preceding verse and the verse that follows. Now, even in fighting, let's look at the rules of engagement. One of the points I want to look at is point number 4 under jihad in context is rules of engagement. We have defined jihad. We have made it very clear that permission to fight is given in case of oppression or aggression against someone. The fighting is encouraged when you are being oppressed, not to sit back and accept injustice and oppression. And fourthly, the rules of engagement. It's very clear in hadith term, in the words of Prophet Muhammad, that no killing of non-combatants, neither women nor children nor the elderly who are not in arms should be killed. People who are not carrying, non-combatants should not be killed. Even if you are fighting, if you are attacking a city which is attacking you or people who are attacking you, if they are amongst them people who are not carrying arms, they cannot be victims of your attack. They could be maybe held prisoner for a while to be questioned and so on, but they cannot be killed. Neither elderly people nor children. No places of worship should be destroyed. No buildings should be destroyed, even in war. No plants should be cut down. No worshippers should be attacked while worshipping, even if they are carrying arms, while they're in worship. Nor should you pollute water supplies. This is very clear from the prophetic injunction of Prophet Muhammad's words. No killing of non-combatants, neither women nor children nor the elderly should be killed. Preserving places of worship, no place of worship should be destroyed. No, do not destroy buildings. Do not destroy plants. Nor attack worshippers, nor pollute water supplies. Then the next point we're looking at is that fighting is permitted only on moral grounds. fighting is permitted only on moral grounds. And if you look at chapter 4, verse 90, it's very, very clear. You know, the fighting is out of principle, not out of passion. It says, chapter 4, verse 90, if they leave you alone, refrain from fighting you, and offer you peace, then God gives you no excuse to fight them. I repeat. If they leave you alone, refrain from fighting you, and offer you peace, then God gives you no excuse to fight them. The next point I wish to bring to our attention is that, let not enmity cause you to swerve from justice. In chapter 5, verse 8, O you who believe, stand up firmly for justice as witnesses to God. And even if you hate a people, if you dislike a people, you genuinely dislike them, let not your hatred cause you to swerve from justice. Be just, for justice is the closest expression to piety. Piety is not prayer and fasting and charity only. More than that, it's manifested in the manifestation of justice, social justice. Chapter 5, verse 8 of the Quran. Let not even your enmity cause you to swerve from justice. Be just, for justice is the closest to piety. And then the last point, not the last point, but the seventh point, granting refuge or protection to the enemy. Chapter 9, verse 6, that even the enemy who give up the arms and ask for protection, grant them protection. This is the Quranic injunction. And then the next point, if, and as we have seen in previous verses as well, if the enemy inclines to peace, and there's no oppression, no injustice, no corruption, no mayhem, if they really genuinely incline to fair peace, then you have no option but to reciprocate that peace. And then finally, the point about when you are victorious. If, for example, there has been a combat and Muslims come to power, or there's Muslim authority or Islamic authority, what should be their approach? Their approach is to pursue spiritual, moral, and economic welfare. That those, the Quran says, if we establish them in the land, this is the mark of believers, true believers, if we establish them in land, they establish regular prayer, which is pursuance of spiritual welfare, and give regular charity, pursuance of economic welfare, and join what is right and forbid what is wrong. And with God rests the decision of all affairs. In other words, pursue economic welfare, pursue spiritual welfare, social welfare, spiritual and moral welfare, and manifesting justice and equity. Well, we have covered quite a bit under religious violence and the Quran. I have a guest, a great friend and a great scholar, Munir Sheikh from the UCLA, who is pursuing a PhD in Islamic studies at UCLA. He'll be our guest for the next hour. When we come back, we have played at the beginning of this hour Pat Robinson and some of his comments that he made, and we have responded through some our discussion, some of the points that he made and others have made. And there was a response directly on CNN to what Pat Robinson had said by Hussein Ibish and of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. And when we come back after a few minutes, we will have that CNN snippet, and then my guest Munir Sheikh. Don't go away. I'll be here. I hope you'll be there too. Keep going. Welcome back to Cal State University, Domingo Hills. You are live on DHTV, locally in South Bay, up to Santa Monica and up to Pasadena, and all over the world on the internet. We welcome you. The SBS 318 course on Islamic culture and civilization. I'm your instructor, Sadullah Khan. And today we are dealing with the question of religious violence and the Quran. We have dealt thus far in the first hour with introducing the Quran, the scope of the Quran in Muslim life, defining and analyzing violence, and then the Quranic text and its historical context. And then we looked at the essential Quran, some of the salient features that that the Quran tries to inculcate within human beings as social beings, and specifically in its adherents and its followers, that life is sacred, that we have a duty to overcome evil with good, not to be destructive nor malicious, to befriend those who do not fight us, or conversely, not to fight those who are friendly to us, not to be aggressive. The Quran advocates compassion and tolerance, and that there is no compulsion in religion. And then looking at jihad in context, we said we define jihad and look at it somewhat, not in too much detail, but in the brief time available to us. Well, 3 hours seems brief when you deal with a topic so vast. But defining jihad somewhat, looking at it, how it developed from the early Meccan phase to the Medinan phase, how permission to fight was granted in the case of oppression, and to fight, when to fight, and for what cause to fight. That fighting is encouraged when one is oppressed or there's injustice, not only against Muslim, but if there's against anyone, if there's any form of injustice, we should try to repel aggression and injustice. That the rules of engagement are very clear, that you don't just kill innocent people, non-combatants, elderly, blow up buildings or attack buildings, or pollute the water, kill plants, kill animals. These are not prescribed at all. In fact, they are condemned. Fighting only permitted on moral grounds, and also an injunction, an exhortation, not to let even your animosity cause you to swerve from justice. Be just under all circumstances. Granting refuge and protection to even the enemy if they incline to peace. And to incline to peace if there's an offer for a genuine peace. And then in victory to pursue social, moral, and spiritual welfare. Now, one of the things we need to understand and look at is that the question is very often raised, why do some religious actors become intolerant of outsiders? And why do they turn to violent actions against those who differ with them? What role does religious players play, or what role do religious players play in the process? What is the relationship between extremism and religious education? Is there some link between religion and violence? Now, Dr. Bruce Hoffman, in his work, The Implication of Terrorism Motivated by a Religious Imperative, he said, for example, that religion and terrorism seem to share a long history, he says. Indeed, many of the words we use in the English language to describe terrorists and their acts are derived from the names of religious groups active several centuries ago. For example, he made reference to the word zealot. Zealot is a reference to a millenarian Jewish sect, which lived around 66 to 73 AD. And they waged a ruthless campaign of both individual assassination and wholesale slaughter, employing a primitive form of chemical warfare, poisoning wells and granaries used by the Romans, and even sabotaging at that time Jerusalem's water supply. Of course, there was a sect, but Zealot was a millenarian Jewish sect. Then we have the assassin, or the hashashin, meaning those who take the hashish, or the imbibe hashish, and they used to commit, said to be Muslim, and their attempt was basically, they were a radical offshoot, of course, of some of the of a Muslim sect. And between 1090 and 1272, for over 100 years, they fought crusaders attempting to conquer present-day Syria and Iran. And these assassins would ritualistically imbibe hashish before committing murder, and so on. Then you get the word thug, for example. Thug is a Indian word that derived from the mid-19th century, where people who were worshippers of Kali, the Hindu goddess of terror and destruction, used to put persons to murder. In fact, it said that 600 to between 600 to 50,000 people, some people go up as far as 50,000 to 1 million, God alone knows, that people were killed at the hand of these people. And they strangled people by death. Killing was by strangulation. And this was done in the name of the Hindu goddess of terror, Kali. And the word thug comes from that, for example. So there is that link. It does not mean mainstream Hinduism that the thugs are linked with, nor mainstream Islam that the assassins are linked with, nor the mainstream Judaism that the zealots are linked with. What is striking, however, about religious terrorism, for want of a better word, is that it is almost exclusively symbolic, performed in a remarkably dramatic way. Moreover, disturbing displays of violence have been accompanied by strong claims of moral justification and enduring absolutism, characterized by the intensity of religious activist commitment and their trans-historical scope of their goals. In other words, you find very often this is a sacramental duty, a divine duty, executed in direct response, they believe, to some theological demand or imperative. And religion serves as a legitimizing force for their actions. And holy terror manifests itself, Dr. Hoffman says, by describing the other persons outside the religious community of those perpetrating the terror, by denigrating them or dehumanizing the opposition by calling them infidels or children of Satan and so on and so forth. And the deliberate use of such adjectives is done to condone and justify the terror which is carried out. It further erodes the constraints of violence and bloodshed by portraying the terrorists as victims and those who are killed as subhuman or anti-religious or anti-God and, you know, worthy of being removed. So we need to understand that when we look how religion has been used, whether it be in the Oklahoma bombing, whether it be in the Twin Tower bombing that we have seen, whether it be on the attack on the Sikh temple by the Indian forces in 1984, I think it was, or whether it be the killing of the Muslims in the Khalili Mosque by Baruch Goldstein, an extremist Jew, for example, or whether it be what we saw happening in Japan by the Aum Shinrikyo, where they killed about 12 people and 5,000 people were affected by the sarin gas in the Tokyo subway. These seem to be violence which was motivated by religious imperative. So what we need to understand that has been there and that has always been there. Sometimes it may be that a particular section of the community, of a religious community, may reach the headlines in very dramatic fashion. And very often, these violence motivated by this kind of religious imperative is very often meant to be public. But it's important for the ordinary public and for the global community at large to understand that this is maybe an offshoot or maybe a particular group of people, and they don't represent the majority, whether it be Buddhism, like you find the Aum Shinrikyo, where we see, for example, Japanese nerve gas attack linked to cult. There are numerous ones of these, for example, headlines that we have seen in the recent years. And of course, the most recent one, September 11th here in our country. But it's unfortunate that some people assume that those who do this are representing Islam as a whole, and that Muslims, therefore, in general, and their scripture, and the Prophet Muhammad, exhort Muslims to this kind of action, and that jihad implies the killing of the infidels or anyone who's not Muslim, and therefore we legitimize terror by means of that religious imperative. Now, we have heard earlier on Pat Robinson, the head of the Christian Coalition, on a CNN late edition program that played on Sunday, 2 days ago, making some allegations and proclaiming Islam not to be a religion of peace, and challenging the President Bush when he said that Islam is a religion of peace. We have a response by Hussein Ibish of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, who responded to what Pat Robertson said. We'll listen to that, and thereafter I'll introduce my honorable guest. Let's go to Hussein Ibish on CNN Late Edition.
Welcome back. We're joined now by Hussein Ibish. He's the communications director for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Sir, welcome to Late Edition.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
You heard Reverend Robertson in the prior segment. He says this book,
yes,
the Quran,
mm-hmm,
teaches violence,
yeah,
in the guise of religion, teaches, mm-hmm, to kill people who are infidels. You agree?
Well, of course not. That's absolutely preposterous. If we want to play this silly, vicious game, there's no problem to do it with the Quran, with the Bible, with the Talmud. You can go into any of these great religious texts and pull out quotes randomly here and there to prove all kinds of things. You can prove the religion is peaceful, you can prove it's violent, you can prove it's for something or against something. We could do this. And if we wanted to stigmatize each other, we can all play this game. You know, there are dozens of websites, anti-Semitic websites with quotes pulled from the Talmud, anti-Christian websites with all kinds of quotes from the Book of Job. Joshua to the book of Revelations. Anyone can play this game if you want to smear and attack one of the great traditions of the world. The question is, what is the history of the tradition? What is the essence of the faith as it has been interpreted throughout the years? And I think there's no doubt that Islam is a peaceful religion. What is Pat Robertson saying? Well, first of all, let me tell you, he doesn't know what he's talking about. He just got on your show and said that in Islam, Muhammad is the only prophet of God. The most elementary fact about Islam is that the Jewish and prophets and Jesus are all prophets of Islam, from Abraham to Jesus. He doesn't know the first thing he's talking about. What he's doing is he's trying to malign and stigmatize an entire community. Why he wants to do that, I don't know, but that's what he's doing, and it's very cynical, and it's really despicable.
Help us on the point you just made about lifting passages from any religious text and putting them into context of what they mean today. Let's take this one. Here's one quote. I believe it's one of the quotes Reverend Robertson cited from the Quran. Those that make war against God and his apostle and spread disorder in the land shall be slain or crucified or have their hands and feet cut off on alternate sides or be banished from the land.
Right. I mean, look, as I say, it's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. Here is a quote ripped from its context, ripped from its this very large holy book, which has been interpreted in many different ways by many different people in dozens of traditions. You're talking about one of the great philosophical traditions of mankind. You pull this quote out and put it down, we'd have to ask, who are the people who are making war against God? And what does this mean? Is this literal? Is it metaphorical? Look, I'm not a theologian, and there's no point in having a theological debate here. We don't need to do it. I could come here, as I say, with quotes from the Talmud and quotes from the Bible and try to paint Judaism and Christianity or any other religion in this negative light too. I think that is, as I say, a really despicable and sick game that we don't need to play. What we need to ask ourselves is, what is Reverend Robertson saying in his piece on the 700 Club that created this controversy? What he was saying overall is, look, in our midst, next to you, there are Muslim neighbors. There are Muslims among us. And they may look normal. They may seem to be normal, reasonable people, but actually they're not. They are different from us. They have a different value system. They hate our culture. They hate our country. They worship an alien and hostile God. They're trying to take over, destabilize, and undermine our Western Christian way of life. That's what he's saying. This is exactly what was said about Jews in the late 19th and early 20th century. This is a slightly warmed over, slightly rehashed version of anti-Semitism. It's coming from very similar quarters, that is to say, far right-wing extremists like the Reverend Robertson. And I think it ought to trouble everyone that what we're getting is just a slightly warmed over version of anti-Semitism, and it's spreading in this country.
Let us continue and bring into the discussion a caller from Kentucky. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you for having me. I'd just like to ask Mr. Ibish how he explains if the religion is not that to promote hatred and murder and so forth, how does that explain the death of Daniel Pearl, who was an innocent American simply doing a job over there?
Yeah, the death of Pearl was absolutely horrible, and it's sad to say that lots of journalists are killed in the world all over the year. This was a particularly heinous and brutal murder, and it was committed by Muslims. But look, there are 1.3 billion Muslims in the world. One-fifth of the people on the planet are Muslims. Obviously, some of them are going to be committing some murders. That no more indicts the faith than the actions of Timothy McVeigh or the Branch Davidians, or the real IRA, or the Orange Order, or any other group of people, the Ku Klux Klan for that matter, who act under the name of Christianity, or a right-wing Jewish extremist in Israel in the settler movement who act in the name of Judaism. I mean, you know, the question is, are we going to really start stigmatizing each other based on guilt by association, and are we going to start pointing the finger at each other collectively, or are we going to ask each other whether we should not actually have a tolerant society, whether it's not more reasonable to judge each other as individuals and to judge traditions as whole traditions and not look for accusations like this. I mean,
what type of challenges do you face, though, from a public?
That was Hossein Ibish of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee appearing on CNN's Late Edition on the 24th of February, this 2 days ago. We welcome you back, of course, to the SBS 318 Islamic Culture and Civilization course locally on television, on Channel 6 and LA 36, and worldwide on the internet. And today we have with us an honorable guest, a dear friend of mine, Mr. Munir Sheikh, who is pursuing his PhD in Islamic Studies at UCLA. Welcome, Brother Munir.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here, and as you can see, we have quite a full program and a mouthful of things.
Absolutely. This is a very significant topic, and one that really there's hardly enough time to discuss all the different facets and elements.
We have heard what Pat Robinson said, and you have heard some of the things that I've said in the first hour. A few questions that I would like to pose, Brother Munir. You know, when we look at the Quran itself, of course, there's text and there's context. Mm-hmm. Now, and of course, there's interpretation, the human understanding. I opened my entire program by making reference to that. Now, what is involved in the interpretation of the Quran, and why might there be variant interpretations, and what does the context really have to do with the interpretation itself?
Sure. I mean, that's kind of a starting point for really trying to understand what does Islam or the Quran have to do with this subject of violence. But even before I try to address that question, one thing that I've noticed in the recent our public discourse about Islam, and in terms of whether it's Pat Robertson or any other spokespersons who have something to say on the issue, you tend to find a comparison of different things. You have a comparison of a sacred text, Islam sacred text, the Quran, with perhaps Western values or with some sort of other religious tradition and ideals. Very rarely do we see a comparison of text to text, or religious tradition to religious tradition, or history to history. If we were to do that, then we could make a more accurate comparison. And we would find that, as Hossein Ibish mentioned, that you can look at any sacred text and pull out various verses and interpret them in certain ways.
Which
to
are highly politically incorrect.
Absolutely. So the methodology of interpretation comes into play, and this is where context is important. Now, Muslims, since September 11th especially, have been expressing, and even before, when it comes to the Quran, have been expressing that many times verses from the Quran are quoted out of context. And this notion of out of context is somewhat trite, but it's actually very true. And there is a very specific context for the verses and the revelation in the historical sense. So there are revelations that occurred to Muhammad when he was living in Mecca. There are verses that occurred when he was in Medina and after he had established a community. And so the nature of those verses vary, and we have to understand that context. We also have to understand that the Quranic text is revealed in a dialectic sense. It's not simply a one-way communication between God and Muhammad, but rather a revelation and an expression of the divine and the presence of the divine in human affairs, mediated through the Prophet Muhammad and communicated to his followers, communicated to humanity at large, ultimately. But in that dialectic process, we see that verses of the Quran have been revealed to address not only universal principles and values, which may be relevant throughout history, throughout time, but also very specific points of information that deal with certain incidences and events and questions that were put to the Prophet in the time of his life. And that is something that must be taken into consideration. And of course, one also has to look at the fact that sacred scriptures tend to have their own inherent rhetorical power. The words are revealed and expressed in a way which signifies something greater, greater themes of justice and goodness and fairness and the grand themes of good versus evil, or achievement and spiritual salvation, and all of these things. So sometimes the words can have a much more powerful effect if we simply fail to appreciate that they're also there for their rhetorical effect.
Looking at the significance of a sacred text within a given tradition, how are variations in interpretations to be resolved? Of course, there are those who would use a particular a verse in the Quran, and they would then say, look, this particular verse in the Quran means this to them. Now, the variation in the text, how, I mean, as I mentioned, God is divine, we believe, and the word of God is the Bible or the Quran. But our understanding is not, we're not divine, we're not perfect. Mm-hmm. We need to understand that from the outset. But within a sacred, within a religious tradition, the significance of a sacred text, how are the variation interpretation to be resolved, the variation interpretation within a given tradition?
Sure, that's also very important. One of the interesting things about early Islamic scholarship among those Muslims who chose to study the Quran and chose to study some of the sayings of the Prophet was that they were very afraid and reticent to interpret too broadly or too specifically, because they knew that this was a very momentous and important act, and they recognized their own inherent intellectual limitations as scholars. And I think perhaps in some cases that reticence has been lost among some who interpret texts today. But the basic method by which some interpretations prevail over others is that those interpretations that seem to make the most sense, seem to be in line with the broader themes of the Quran, looking at how verses relate to each other, one can come up with an overall picture on a particular issue, whether it's gender relations or whether it's combat and warfare, as some of the verses that you described. Mm-hmm. All of those things, scholars study and write and reflect, and eventually over time a consensus develops, and that consensus grows into a larger tradition over time, over centuries. And when you have a situation such as in the modern period, when certain kinds of interpretations which may cast non-Muslims as somehow evildoers, or which may cast or which may ascribe to Islam some sort of will to power, these kinds of interpretations one can see are totally outside the norm of what the historical interpretations have been. And I think one has to juxtapose certain kinds of interpretations with the larger consensus on any given issue, and that is very important. Since there's no specific hierarchy of authority in Islam, it all comes down to Muslims collectively engaging in something called ijtihad, a reasoned approach, a desire to try to understand the divine will, and that's only an attempt. It is not something that has an absolute end.
Mm-hmm. It's conclusive. And by the way, ijtihad also from the same root word, jihad.
Absolutely.
Strive for understanding of
that's
something.
Right.
One question that's very often been asked, Brother Munir, is who speaks for Islam? This is a question because people assume that when you say the interpretation of the Quran, and the question is asked, but maybe that's your interpretation, you know, and as you mentioned so appropriately, that of course, you know, that there's a broader historical context, a continuous legacy and tradition, you know, which we have received, and no particular interpretation is definitive and the ultimate one, and it's a complete process. The very fact that there's an ongoing process of understanding the Quran, ongoing interpretation, and never in history has there ever been, people have preferred particular scholars to others, has always been there, but there's never been a call for, look, let's end, because the whole idea of Islam being applicable to all times and the Quran being applicable to all times would immediately be killed off, that notion would be killed off. So the idea of a text revealed in an original context, but being applicable in principle to the changing vicissitudes of time, by its very nature needs to be interpreted, reinterpreted, understood and re-understood. Look at its original context and then, you know, look at the context and how do you take the text from that context into this context.
I think one of the difficulties in modern times is that Muslims, because they underwent a colonial experience in which their lands were occupied, their educational systems were disrupted, their economies were infiltrated by European powers, which simply in the course of history became much more powerful, that created a certain kind of intellectual reactive discourse, which continues to have its legacy today, which has kind of obscured that trajectory that you're talking about, which is open-ended, which is not something that necessarily looks backward and tries to recreate some pristine state, but rather continues to see history unfolding as part of the divine will. And that is something that Muslims today are grappling with and trying to return to that kind of approach of looking at the constant necessity to engage in interpretation that is consistent with the teachings of the Prophet and the broader themes of the Quran.
It's an ongoing part of the legacy, it's a continue. Now, how should you look at the central role given you, especially since September 11th, central role given to Islam or Islamic teachings in the discourse about terrorism and about violence going on currently?
Well, it's very interesting to see that Islam is kind of becomes kind of central and stigmatized in a way with respect to this issue of terrorism and violence. Of course, violence is something that is age old since the beginning of time. But what's interesting in the discourse itself is that just as in medieval times, Christian discourse or Western discourse has tended to project its own weaknesses and its own concerns onto the other. And likewise, within the Islamic tradition, there has been this sense of projecting upon the Christian world or Christendom its own weaknesses. So this is a very interesting scenario where two faith traditions that are extremely close to each other in their ultimate principles and their ultimate desires for human spirituality, because they're so close together, perhaps is a reason why there is this tension and discomfort, because they're more close to each other than sometimes those who benefit from certain authoritative positions within the faith. Those positions can be undermined if the followers of these traditions were to truly appreciate how close they are. Now, there are going to be differences in liturgy, differences in specific ritual practices, but the overall theological ideas, the overall notion of this life being a temporary life in which one is given an opportunity to prove one's spiritual growth and one's goodness in order to be rewarded with an afterlife, those things are common, of course, to all three of the Abrahamic faiths, and we may even extend some of those concepts to other faith traditions. So the very closeness is a problem, and I think it contributes to this kind of negative discourse. And that's something that has been studied in academia as part of what's called Orientalism, the whole notion of creating the other. And that this was concomitant, part and parcel of the project of imperialism. And that is something that is well known. What happens is that Islamists, at least those who are extremists among those Muslims who see for themselves an Islamic frame of life, and that in itself is not something that should be a cause for concern necessarily, or something that should be disparaged. The question is, what kinds of means and what kinds of discourse do Islamists generate? Now, there's diversity within that. Those who are more extreme and more limited in their discourse, who see those who are not Muslim as somehow an enemy, those people essentially, in my way of looking at it, match those who are extremists in evangelical Christianity, who see the enemy in those who are not Christian. So I think that is where the problem lies. But the idea that religion has a role to play in society or in the further development of our global human community, that in itself should not necessarily be troubling. So I don't think Islam is really the issue, nor is Christianity really the issue, or any other faith. The real issue is that there is a global clash of interests going on a variety of levels. There is a difference in the way resources are distributed across the planet. Those who produce certain resources may or may not be the beneficiary of those resources. Wealth that is generated may or may not be disseminated properly. And there are various social and cultural phenomena that exist on the planet, and these are problems in and of themselves. Certainly we should, from any philosophical or religious tradition, be it just kind of secular philosophy or Christianity or Islam or Judaism or Hinduism, we should all strive to find within those source materials of those traditions a means to promote justice and equality and fairness and gender egalitarianism and all of those essentially universal values which have generally been identified with the West and perhaps have been best thus far manifested in what we call Western secular society, but not necessarily exclusively so. And I think we need to look at that and not really buy into this whole notion that somehow violence and terrorism are intimately and intrinsically linked to Islam, but rather are the byproducts of particular material and political phenomenon that exists on the planet at this time.
We are joining us here at Cal State University, Domingo Hills. We are live on DHTV and locally and online, worldwide on the internet. You are welcome to call us for your suggestions or comments or questions that you may have. 1-800-339-1193. 1-800-339-1193. Please, you're welcome to call in. We have Mr. Munir Sheikh, a PhD student pursuing his PhD in Islamic Studies at UCLA. And one of the interesting points you brought up here is the whole issue of Islam in the West. Is Islam compatible with values often associated, and you made reference to that towards the end of your remark, is Islam compatible with the values often associated with the West, such as pluralism? It's not necessarily a Western concept, but sure. I mean, but associated with pluralism, racial and gender equality, advancement through merit, human rights, democracy, freedom of expression, and so on and so forth. This is a question very often asked. Mm-hmm. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think it's important for Muslims themselves. It is really up to Muslims in a general global sense, or specifically in the United States. Muslims have to decide to construct a vision and a reading of their sacred text and their tradition, which brings out those qualities that we know that are universal, and which may even be expressed in Chinese philosophy or Judaism or Christianity, or in the case of the West. The West has its own particular history and evolution, or what we call the West, I should say, in quote marks. The liberal secular society in which we live today has emerged because of a distancing of society from direct religious influence. Religion has become a personalized phenomenon, and that is the way in which we have arrived at the position we are today. Okay. That's one particular way in which these values can be expressed in a secular liberal context. That doesn't mean that they cannot also be expressed in a more directly religious context. Muslims would argue that that is possible. Observers may say that as of yet Muslims have not demonstrated that to any significant degree. Again, that may partly be due to the fact that there was an age of imperialism and there was a kind of interruption of a natural progression of Muslim society.
It still emerges from colonialism, the after effects of colonialism.
Absolutely. So, I mean, those are things that we can speculate about, but the values themselves have their roots in Islam, just as they have their roots in other traditions, because they're basically the things that human beings aspire to.
Universal values.
Absolutely. And just to give you one example, the Quran explicitly has verses which identify Jews and Christians as people of the book. And it specifically has verses that talk about how those who believe in God and the prophets and the Day of Judgment, those who do good, on them shall be no fear. They will be rewarded by God. Mm-hmm. So presumably they are people who God would reward because they are good people and they are God's people. They're not Muslim per se. Mm-hmm. They are people who God recognizes and rewards. Mm-hmm. So these are very specific Quranic verses which imply that there is a broader vision of humanity than just simply salvation for Muslims or something like that. Even Muslims themselves don't believe that they are automatically, by virtue of believing in the tenets of Islam, somehow going to be admitted into heaven or paradise. So even that is questionable. But the point is, the fact that this verse exists in the Quran, but a similar verse may not exist in the Torah, for example. Perhaps there is a more exclusivist notion of God's favor, or within Christian tradition generally, those who do not accept Christ are not expected to be rewarded with paradise. So we can interpret those traditions as somehow being very inclusive, exclusive and very limited and narrow, whereas from just this standpoint, we can say that Islam has the seed material to have a broad vision. So again, it's a matter of each members of each faith community going and looking at their text and deciding for their age and for their time, and in our case, a global age with a pluralistic society, the decision can be made within the tradition or not made. It is up to the scholars and the interpreters of the tradition and the followers of the tradition to determine what sort of vision they have for their practicing of their faith. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily, it's not a question of changing the basic tenets of the faith.
Of course not.
Belief in God or belief in prophets or belief in the afterlife. Those things would remain constant. But how faith and life are manifested in a different kind of context, those things can change, and Muslims have and will continue to look at those issues. And
as they should.
And that discourse is happening within the Muslim community. Sometimes those who are not within the Muslim community are not privy to that discourse, and they may see Islam as somehow monolithic or static, unchanging, when in fact there's great amount of debate and discussion going on in many of these issues among Muslims.
Yeah. I think also that maybe, you know, there's a lot of interfaith dialogue going on, but sometimes people are not, as you said, privy to the kind of intra-faith dialogue that's taking place and discussions and debates. And perhaps if people are more aware of this, they would understand that, you know, how much closer we are in many things and how closer we are to resolve some of the issues that we are generally accused of not even addressing at all. One of the other questions we need to look at, obviously, is that, you know, the age of... there was the age of, you know, the medieval times, the imposition of the church or the religion upon people, or what people thought to be God's word was the order of the day. Then there was a period of what you call the modern period, the modernist period, which was the age of reason. Mm-hmm. And now I think with the postmodern period, somewhat to me, I believe, is more a return to what I would call, as a Muslim, looking at our legacy, to what Islam would be more comfortable with. Mm-hmm. It's a tempering of religion with our reason for the understanding of religion. In other words, reason is not exclusive. It does not have exclusive monopoly over the truth or ascertaining the truth. Nor do our understanding of religion, how these two, and I think the postmodern period is moving to the area where not one over the other and the other over the other, how these two combine. Mm-hmm. And Islam, the idea of aqal and iman, mm-hmm. has always been the idea of the reason.
Yes.
And faith has always been together. There's never been a dichotomy. How would you respond to that?
Well, that's a very interesting insight. I think there certainly is, there are multiple dimensions to life. And so one of the things to understand is that the whole idea of postmodernism came about as a way of moving beyond a certain modernist project that was established in Europe and in the West, you know, based on the Age of Enlightenment, which was a wonderful period of time and a shakeout in terms of intellectual ideas about these universal ideas that came about: democracy, pluralism, merit, representative government. All of these things emerged out of the Enlightenment period, and they were important in creating models for how governments or how societies might organize themselves. Yeah. Now, that whole notion of progress and modernism is important, but if it is simply assumed that such ideas can be automatically transplanted or exported to other parts of the world in some sort of blind fashion, that becomes problematic, because different parts of the world economically and socially are at different points. And one simply can't assume that other places, in order to progress, they need to follow the exact same steps that Europe went through.
Yes.
That may or may not be the case. And scholars today who look, you know, political scientists or historians have essentially rejected that kind of modernist take on human evolution or social evolution. But what postmodernism allows for is that we can look at the plurality of experience and recognize that truth often isn't on one side or another of, you know, two different groups who may be thinking differently or contending with each other, but perhaps both groups have some parts of the truth, and both experiences are valuable, and values can be shared, not in an absolute sense, but so there is room for some cultural relativism as well as some sort of universal truths, but nothing is dictated by one cultural system over another.
We have a call on the line. Please, been very kind and patient, waiting for some time, I think. We have Sai, is it, calling from Los Angeles?
Yes, Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam. Is it Sai?
Yes, I'm an Albanian Muslim, and I'd like to ask a question there.
Sure, please go ahead, sir.
Okay, I don't want to give a lecture, but when you're talking about the terrorism and violence, I'm wondering why the media doesn't bring this out. I think it's your responsibility to do so, is that we as Muslims, having suffered from Kosovo and Bosnia-Herzegovina, have been the victims of a lot of terrorism ourselves. We have been the victims many times, and you have, I can show you on, you know, CBN, all the Christian channels, they're always saying it's a biblical prophecy to kill Muslims, you know, like the Serbs say all the time, that's a prophecy to kill all the Muslims, and then Christ will come. They believe it's a prophecy to kill all the Palestinians, and they're justifying this terrorism. Isn't it logical that in this kind of pogromist atmosphere, you're going to have some Muslims that are, of course, going to become terrorists?
Yes, a very valid question there, Sai. I think one of the things that, you know, I remember one day I was called immediately after September 11th. I was called and to speak about Islam and terrorism or jihad or something of that sort, I remember. And I said, you know, that I'm the perfect candidate. And people laughed because I was making a joke. I said, I'm serious. Okay. Because Muslims have been more a victim of terror in the last 20 years than any other people. I mean, most of the people who are refugees right now, 60% of the refugees in the world are Muslim, by the way. You see what happened in Bosnia, in Chechnya, in Kashmir, in Palestine.
Well, one of the problems, of course, is that different people offer different definitions of what terrorism is. Yes. And there is no consistent standard. Now, if we apply a consistent standard, then we can begin to look at the world's problems and the different actors in a particular scenario and identify who is the oppressor and who is the oppressed, mm-hmm. and leave it at that without privileging one view or another, without sympathizing with one view or another, but simply sympathizing with those who are oppressed.
Yes, I think one of the important things that we need to understand, I think, is that, you know, sometimes they say one man's terrorist, another man's freedom fighter. Being from South Africa myself, I know Nelson Mandela was an outright terrorist as far as the media in our country was concerned. And, of course, one of the greatest freedom fighters of all time.
Right.
You know, so it just depends how we look at things. But I thank Sai for the call that he made, and very emotional about the whole thing. But I think, you know, very often people forget, you know, look at Bosnia, Chechnya, Kosovo. So right now, as we are talking, mm-hmm. Muslims are the victims of state-organized terror, and well-orchestrated, by the way.
That's right.
So, you know, this is and it's unfortunate. Whoever perpetrates it, whether it be Muslim or non-Muslim, whether it be September 11th or any other event, the fact is that we need to understand how religion often is used and abused. People who came over to this country in slave ships, mm-hmm. Good Ship Jesus, Holy Mary, the name of the best of our legacy in our history, the most sacred people, the names were used to justify the most heinous acts.
I mean, I think the challenge is that we need to recognize that there are many, many different factors that are operating in the world, you know, different interests and politics. And sometimes our country, which is a wonderful, great country, one in which I'm very proud to be a part of, but, you know, its relationships externally are mixed. There are things that we do that are very positive and beneficial and compassionate, and there are things that we do that are not so positive and compassionate. And so those things do have implications and they do have ramifications. I'm not one who advocates simply condemning U.S. policy, nor am I one who simply, although I am patriotic, I am not a blind patriot who will simply assume that everything that human beings who are fallible, who happen to be policymakers, that they somehow are making the right choices all the time. I think that is also a very naive view.
Yes. So my country, right when they are right, not my country, wrong or right.
Right.
That is very important. We thank Munir Sheikh, thank you very much
for
being here. It's a pleasure, and for enhancing the discourse and for the contribution you have made. We surely will get you back sometime. A dear friend of mine, Mr. Munir Sheikh,
thank you.
Who is from a PhD, pursuing his PhD in Islamic studies at UCLA, and as you can see, a knowledgeable scholar. And we hope to have you back very, very soon, Munir. And thank you very much for your contribution.
Excellent program. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Pleasure. We're taking a break now. Don't go away. We'll come back and we'll be doing something on fundamentalism, defining some terms which we didn't complete last week, and some of the terms and terminologies, and with closing remarks. So we have a last hour to go. Very short time. See you. I'll be here. I hope you'll be there. Welcome back to Khalsa University, Domingo Hills. We're coming live to you on LA Channel 6, LA 36, and as well as on the internet worldwide. I'm your instructor, Sadullah Khan, for the SBS 318 course and upper division course offered here at Khalsa University, Domingo Hills. Welcome locally, welcome globally. The topic we are dealing with today is religious violence in the Quran. And of course, we have dealt with the scope of the Quran, the essential Quran, defined jihad in context, and also analyzed somewhat in the last hour the violence which is motivated by a religious imperative, and how religion sometimes is used to legitimize force and violence, how religious leaders deem violence morally justifiable, and also somehow how legitimizing terror by demonizing the opposition. And we had a wonderful guest, dear friend Munir Sheikh, who is pursuing his PhD in Islamic studies at UCLA. And we dealt with the questions of interpretation of the Quran and the varied interpretations, and how, perchance, how these variations could be resolved. And of course, the significance of sacred text within religious traditions.
and also the central role given to Islam in this whole issue of terrorism and violence which is going on currently, as well as looking at whether Islam is compatible with values associated with the West, not necessarily Western, but associated with the West, such as racial and gender equality, pluralism, equality, advancement through merit, human rights, democracy, freedom of expression, and so on. And also how Islam could be viewed in the light of the postmodern theory. And Munir Sheikh dealt with it so excellently and eloquently, and we are eternally indebted to him for that, and we're thankful to him for that. Now, last week, we dealt with some of the terms and terminologies which were essential for our discussion and understanding of Islam. I have, a list of terms that we have not been able to complete last week. And one of the terms that I wish to deal with, not necessarily an Arabic term or specifically a Muslim term, in fact, definitely not a Muslim term, but somewhat associated with Islam, and even in today's discussion, it came up quite a few times, and I thought I need to address that particular issue and how I understand and how we understand that particular the term. So I'll be dealing with terms and terminology for the next 40 minutes or so, and before the concluding remarks. So we will mesh up and try to pay off the terms and terminology of last week, which will clarify some of our understanding of some of the conceptions or misconceptions about Islam, as well as to clarify some of the issues regarding issues of fundamentalism, jihad, and terrorism, very often associated and wrongfully so with Islam itself. We have a call on the line. Please go ahead.
Hello?
Joe calling from East Los Angeles. Go ahead, Joe.
Yes. I want to discuss Pat Robinson.
Yes, sir.
The Christian leader.
Yes, sir.
He versed some verses.
Yes.
Concerning that, I don't have them in my memory precisely.
Yes, yeah.
How he worded them.
Yes.
But it goes something like this, that one must kill the infidels.
Yeah.
And that one must lie in wait for them and kill them.
Yes.
And that God will punish them, you know.
Yes.
In their death.
Yes.
And I know there's also other verses that I don't know if I'm correct or not, that state if you run into an unbeliever, mm-hmm. or a pagan or a kafir or whatever you call it,
mm-hmm.
that one must give them a choice to either kind of like accept Islam or kill them.
Okay.
And I want to know if this is the essence of Islamic fundamentalism, particularly speaking the Wahhabism, because I see that Wahhabism is the same religion practiced by the Taliban, the same religion practiced in the madrasas in Pakistan, and the same religion that's practiced in Saudi Arabia, and also which kind of like it concerns me, because we have a Wahhabist church, the King Fahd Mosque in Culver City. Mm-hmm. So I want to know how literally does the Muslim community take those verses to, kill the infidel? And now that Pat Robinson has exposed that portion of the Quran, I want your take on the situation there.
Yeah. Thank you, Joe, for the call. I appreciate your question. A long question, though, but multidimensional. I'll try to answer all of them if I can. I just grabbed in the first hour. I made reference to some of the verses which Pat Robertson made reference to, and gave the preceding verses and the context of the verse. Of course, first of all, we need to understand that there's no verse in the Quran that says kill the infidels. It is those who are fighting you, and of course, at the time of Prophet Muhammad, those who are fighting the Muslims were very often members of his own family who were the heads of the Quraysh, who were not necessarily Christian. The Prophet Muhammad never went to war with any Christians, for the matter, in his lifetime. So what we need to understand is that reference here was made to the polytheists at that time, some of them who were uncles of his, who were heading the army against him because they felt that Islam was a threat to their political and economic stability, and also to their control and hierarchy of the offices that they held. So there are verses regarding war. Of course there are verses regarding war, and they were revealed in context. There's no verse whatsoever in the Quran that says, await the infidel and kill them, and so on and so forth. The quote of Pat Robinson, which we heard early on in the first hour of the program, which we are now into the third hour, the reference he made was to those, there's a verse in the Quran which says, and again in a particular context, in a, when you have a particular situation, and a particular government, particular authority, a particular context, where for example it said that those who wage war against God and His apostle, that needs to be understood, and what does it mean, how is it interpreted, and those who cause corruption in the land, such people should be exiled, either killed or crucified, or cut off their hands from the opposite side. No Muslim country does that. The Prophet Muhammad himself didn't do that in his lifetime. But it was a threat to those people, a warning to those people who are going to engage in corruption and trying to wage war against the Prophet and the Quran. It was never carried out by the Prophet himself, and nor is it an injunction for any fighting against people of another faith. Secondly, Christians and Jews are not regarded as infidels in the Quran. They're regarded as people of the book. It's an honorary term used in the Quran referring to Christians and Jews. And in the previous hour, we had an excellent scholar who made reference to verses in the Quran, chapter 2, verse 64, for example, which says that those who believe, those who are Jews or Christians, who believe in God and do good deeds and believe in the day of accountability, God will grant them the reward for their deeds. And so heaven is not exclusively for Muslims, or reward for that matter, exclusively for Muslims. Nor are Muslims ensured that just because you are Muslim, you are going to heaven. We need to understand that too. The third part is, of course, that you mentioned he exposed the Quran. The Quran is open, brother. Please, you're welcome at any time to open the Quran. And please, as you are listening to me, look at the Quran and you can open the quotes and give me the quotes. Rabbi Robertson himself made reference to what, when he was trying to define jihad, not even from his own understanding, nor from any Quranic text, nor from any Islamic text. He quoted the Encyclopedia Britannica and mentioned one portion of a sentence, which was really ridiculous and unbelievable for a person of, I assume, his intelligence, not to have used something as which seems so sinister and so cynical and also inappropriate. But nonetheless, there is no Quranic verse that says, wait for them. Yes, in the case of war, there's something else. And I've given clearly the Quran, the essentials of the Quran, and cases of war and so on and so forth. Nor can you fight non-combatants. So you can't just wait for a person because he's an infidel. And what do you mean by infidel? Who is an infidel? The last part of the question, very interesting, was the issue of Wahhabism. Wahhabism is a reformist movement started by Imam Abdul Wahhab, Muhammad Abdul Wahhab, in the previous century, in the 19th century, and a puritanical movement. And of course, there were people who, from his own family, his own father and brother, of course, opposed him because he was very literal in some ways, and even considered, some of his followers even considered other Muslims not to be complete believers because they accused them of, over sanctifying graves or saints and so on, and considered even those Muslims who did those kind of things, the Sufis and so on, as they accused, as also being part of the infidels or non-believers. So this is not the general view of Muslims, and the Wahhabism is not the dominant school, by the way. It is a school of thought somewhat. It is prevalent in Saudi Arabia, and yes, people like Bin Laden and some of the people in Pakistan and maybe in India too subscribe to that, and maybe in other parts of the world as well. But to assume that a person, because they are Muslim and they are Saudi Arabian, or because of they are Arab, that all of them prescribe to a literalist meaning of the Quran, and therefore they promote the idea of killing infidels. Even literal meaning of the Quran does not encourage that, by the way. We need to understand that. So I don't think that you have to lose any sleep over that. Very often I've been attacked by people who are maybe of the Wahhabi school for saying that, I'm not too literal with the Quran, or that I'm too soft on, non-Muslims, even on other Muslims. Who may be Sufi or Shi'i or different schools of thought, which are well accepted in Islam, by the way. So when we have an exclusivist mentality, that is a problem in itself. Sometimes those who have an exclusivist mentality may be good at heart and may have good ideas and may be sincere itself, but they don't speak on behalf of the rest of the faith. So please, I need you to understand that. Now, again, Brother John brought up a question there himself, on the question of fundamentalism. And I wish to just briefly, in the time allotted, deal with that definition, or my understanding of it at least. Now, the word fundamentalist, extremist, fanatic is always, it seems recently, always to be aligned or prefixed to the word Islam or Muslims. When we found that Daniel Pearl was killed, so brutally killed in Pakistan, by Muslims, by the way, it was assumed that that it was Islamic militants. Why Islamic? Say militants, say terrorists, say fanatics if you want to. Why the word Islamic is used? This is a major problem that Muslims do have, and I too have with that. That it's almost an association of terms. Muslim, fanatic. Islamic, extremist. And this is really a problem, and it's really a tremendous amount of bias and a display of a great amount of bigotry. And it's very inappropriate, by the way, and irresponsible. Now, it is ironic that despite the common theological background between the major religion in the West, which is Christianity, and a century and centuries long interaction with Islam, the relationship between the West and Islam is still very often marked by ignorance, conflict, and stereotyping from both sides. At present, the mind of many Westerners, for whom the history of Islam and its positive influence on the West are at best vague notions, their knowledge of an attitude towards Islam and the followers of Islam have been shaped by contemporary violent images encapsulated in terms such as Islamic fundamentalism and Muslim terrorist or Islamic terrorism. So often have the words Islam and Muslims been linked by the Western media to violent and negative terms that it is often difficult to distinguish where reality ends and where truth begins, or where reality ends and myth begins. Now, when we look at the Webster's Dictionary defining the term fundamentalism, it defines it as a, and I quote, a movement in 20th century Protestantism fundamental to Christian life and teaching. So we can see from that, it originally implied adherence to a literal interpretation of the scripture and was attributed specifically to the movement in the American Christian Church. Now, beyond that, my understanding is that all those who call for a return to foundational beliefs or the fundamentals of a religion may also be classified as fundamentalists. In that sense, the term fundamentalist could include all practicing Muslims who accept the Quran as the word of God and the example of the Prophet Muhammad as the normative model for living, which many Muslims do. However, by the same token, I would assume that any person who follows the fundamentals of his faith, whether Hindu, Buddhist, Christian, Jew or Muslim, following the fundamentals of their faith, could be termed fundamentalist in that term. And in that way, it is a positive term. However, how did people who adhere to the principles of their faith become the victims of a term? It is an unfortunate reality that the media often reinforces the equation of Islam with danger, with terror, with threat, and viewing the Islamic world, 1.2 billion by the way, with catchwords like Islamist, militant, fundamentalist, and terrorist. The apparent danger and subsequent consequence of Muslims in general being mischaracterized in this manner manifests itself by the devastation wrought on the Chechen Muslims by Russian aggression, subsequent to the Chechens being termed Islamic fundamentalist or militant Islamist. It is evident from contemporary Israeli, American, Algerian and Indian models that once Muslims are branded fundamentalists, once they are deemed militants, their struggle against tyranny, no matter how just, whether in Bosnia, whether in Chechnya, whether in Kashmir or whether in Palestine, loses its legitimacy. And their victimization by any and all means becomes virtually legitimate. Any Islamist threat to the accepted hegemony has to be crushed at all cost, and the silence of the media is then assured because the war or the fight is against the threat. We have a call on the line. Please go ahead, state your name. Samuel calling from Los Angeles. Please go ahead, Samuel.
Yes, I was just wanted to comment.
Please go ahead, Samuel.
On the program, I think it's very good that you're doing this, so people have a good understanding of what Islam is.
Thank you, Samuel.
And I think that's very good because Islam is peace, and I think that's a very important thing. And that not only should we just look at something like this, like a TV, You should look at the actions of all other Muslims who are peaceful people.
Yes.
You know, we're all peaceful people, and we're disciplined. I am a newly converted Muslim, and I think that this is very good, and your recitation of the Quran really helped me out, because I'm just getting started, and I really wanted to comment and just thank you for having this on a TV and putting it on. It was very, very good, and I know it's not ended, but I would love to hear more. And I just feel real good that it was, you know, that you're saying what you're saying. But I do. If people would just look at people at go around the mosque and just look at how people are. I've been to mosque. You know, and it's a very, very structured and very disciplined, very helpful to you, because you feel good about yourself when you are practicing Islam.
Samuel, thank you very much for your call and your contribution and for your kind comments and your sentiments. God bless you, and thank you for the support. We're doing the best we can, and thank you to Khalsa University, Domingo Hills, for affording this opportunity and making it available to the public, not only to the students who are registered for the course, but even to the public in general, locally in Los Angeles, through the television here, live, DHTV, and worldwide on the web, and we're really grateful. And thank you for your comments, Samuel. I appreciate your kind sentiments that you expressed. Now, I was just making reference to the issue of fundamentalism. I believe has been unduly suffixed to Muslims and Islam. Equating Islam with the negative image of fundamentalism is unjustifiable. And just like the Crusader term, holy war, is imposed on Muslims. It's not an Islamic term, by the way. So I think that it's important that this term, fundamentalism, in its negative sense, if it means people who adhere to their faith, then I think every Jew or Christian or Muslim, a true follower, I believe, would then be a fundamentalist in that regard. But to use it in a negative sense, as a threat, as a posing a threat, or as a manifesto of potential violence, I think we have serious problems with that. Now, going on to the terms of last week, which we did not complete, and I think that we have some time, perhaps half an hour, to deal with some of these terms. And I believe that we could perhaps take some more calls. Please, you are welcome to call with any comments or any criticism or any suggestions or any questions that you may have. 1-800-339-1193. Please call us at 1-800-339-1193. I'm your instructor, Sadullah Khan, presenting the live from Khalsa Domingo Hills on DHTV, the SBS 318 Upper Division course on Islamic culture and civilization. Please feel free to call us at this number, 1-800-339-1193. Whether you have a view supporting what we are saying or contributing something, challenging what we have to say, please feel free. The program is yours, and the platform is yours to express your opinion, your agreement or disagreement, or your comments or criticism. Now, the first term, last week we concluded with the term Hajj, which of course was the pilgrimage and an annual event, the largest annual convention of faith, where 3 to 5 million people gather annually. And they've been doing so from the time of Prophet Muhammad, not necessarily in so large numbers initially, but certainly in the last few decades we found thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, and in the last 20, 30 years, millions of people coming from all over the world, spending the 12th month, the first few days, specifically from the 8th to the 13th, in Mecca and its vicinity, and of course donning in the clothes of Ihram. And we have seen last week a report, ABC report, where we found a report by Michael Wolff, an excellent piece done by ABC on the Hajj itself. We will go on to the next terms, which I feel is important, because very often when we deal with Muslim people or read Muslim texts or articles relating to Islam, we come across some of these terms. And last week we made reference to some of them, like Adhan, which is a call to prayer. And some people assume that because they very often hear it in many parts of the world, when they go into the Middle East, to Africa, to Far East, you find 1.2 billion Muslims worldwide. In many mosques you find the call to prayer. unfortunately, many people on the television and more specifically in the movies see the Adhan or hear the Adhan in the background while they're showing some Middle Eastern terrorist mixing a bomb or preparing the bomb for something. And I was afraid they may misconstrue Adhan, which is a call to prayer, a call to success, a call to spirituality, a call to purity, a call to commemorating the greatness of God, as maybe a call to terrorism, which is completely the opposite of what the call is. So terms like that. So we have a few terms that we need to complete. And the first one for today, which I will be dealing with, and we hope to complete this up to Z, we have about 20-21 terms. The first one is halal. Now, you very often find Muslims mentioning the term halal is the food halal or the eat halal food, somewhat like the Jewish term kosher. Halal implies something that is lawful and permissible, that's inherently acceptable, that's pure. And of course, it doesn't only refer to, it primarily refers to food and so on, but even to actions and deeds. Is something permissible? Is this acceptable under Islamic law? Is it acceptable according to the Islamic tradition as a whole? And so on. So you find the issue of halal very often manifested in questions of food and drink. For example, Muslims don't eat pork. We don't eat animals that have died of themselves unless they are slaughtered properly. We don't eat animals that are slaughtered in the name of an idol, for that matter. It must be slaughtered in the name of God. And of course, for example, we don't imbibe wine and so on and so forth. So halal is the lawful, the permissible. Then the impermissible, for example, the next term is haram, which is the unlawful and the impermissible, the prohibited, the forbidden. For example, here we'll find the term haram, which is now the opposite of halal, is that which is forbidden. In other words, intoxicants, gambling, imbibing of drugs, for example. So this is haram. And even sometimes dealing with dress. You cannot walk naked, for example. You should not be undressed in public, for that matter. Not to be vulgar, to be abusive, to insult. These are all terms that are dealing with forbidden, unacceptable, and so on. But very often, in Muslim terminology, in general discussion, dealing with forbidden food, forbidden drink, and so on and so forth. Then we have the term hijab. And by the way, we will be dealing with these terms, hijab, specifically later on. We'll deal with the issue of women's rights and so on and so forth. When I deal with a program later on, somewhat in a few weeks' time, on misconceptions about Islam, we hope to deal on somewhere along the line on these issues. I won't be dealing too much in detail with it today. But hijab basically means a covering and applies to clothes of modesty for both male and female. More specifically, in the case of the female, the body is considered more sensuous, more appealing, and therefore you find that there is a greater restriction in Islamic law on covering or uncovering parts of the body. It doesn't imply covering the face at all. That's just a custom that people do, and they're welcome to do that. But basically, you'll find that some people, many Muslims, would dress like how a Roman Catholic nun would dress, for example. Some would dress in a manner whereby the clothing is somewhat loose. It doesn't imply covering the entire body, eyes, nose, and everything else. No, hijab refers to modest covering, covering ourselves, and basically covering oneself with modesty. And of course, there are prescriptions for both male and female regarding this. The next term we're dealing with is hijrah. Hijrah means migration, but before we come to that, I see we have a call on the line. Please go ahead, we have a call on the line. Let's go to the caller. We have Samuel calling from LA. Yes, Samuel. Do you have Samuel? I think we lost the caller. Who do we have on the line there?
This is Joe.
Yes, sir. Go ahead, sir.
Okay, I have a question for you, which is valid if you actually believe that the Quran is the word of God.
Yes.
In chapter 8, verse 60,
yes,
it says to the people who are going to be following the prophet,
yes,
that they should prepare against them, yeah, being the infidels. They should
prepare against the infidels
with leather arms and cavalry. I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Let me just finish the verse,
okay,
and then you please explain.
All right.
It says, you should prepare against the infidels whatever arms and cavalry you can muster, that you may strike terror in the hearts of the enemies of God and of your own.
Right.
And others besides them not known to you but known to God.
Right.
Whatever you spend in the way of God will be paid back to you in full, and no wrong will be done to you. So this, so it seems to me that...
Jojo, hold it, Joe. Can you read the next verse? Read the next verse, please. Read the next verse. Read the verse after that.
I am. There's a little break, so if you don't give me... there's a pause, so if you stop...
No, please continue the verse.
I'm going to read the next verse. Yes, please. Yes, the next one is verse... let me just continue. It says... verse 61 says, but if they are inclined to peace,
uh-huh.
make peace with them and have trust in God.
Oh, yes.
And then it goes ahead and says, for okay. he hears all and knows everything.
Right, okay? Now let me respond. Yes, I believe the Quranic text. I believe in the Quran and I am a Muslim and I accept that this is what God revealed. It's not an imposition upon you and you don't have the obligation to or the responsibility to believe in it. It's a choice that you have. This is a particular verse referring to those who are fighting you. I think perhaps you may have missed the first hour of the program where I dealt specifically with those verses. And I have made reference, if you look in my discussion on jihad in context, in point number, point number 8, under jihad in context, which I dealt with in detail, I made reference to two verses. Chapter 60, verse 8, and chapter 8, verse 60 to 64. But anyway, that is those who are fighting you, brother. I made it very clear. When those who are fighting you in the context of war, you need to understand that. Of course, prepare against them all four forms of what we are doing against Afghanistan. We are preparing all forms of terror against them. So it's the form of war. But if they incline to peace. So look at the entire thing in context. It doesn't say fight them and terrorize them. Yes, put terror into the hearts who are terrorizing you. But if they incline to peace, you incline to peace as well. Yes, accept that, sir. I have no qualms with that whatsoever. Going on to the... thank you very much for the call, Joe.
I'm sorry, that didn't answer the question. Because
what is the question?
The verse does not say you only prepare terror against those who are terrorizing you.
What does it say?
It says that you prepare terror...
No, please, I would like people who are listening, I think we lost the caller... I would like you to open to the Quran in chapter 8, verse 16. It specifically refers not to that, the infidels, no infidels mentioned there. It says, fight against, prepare yourself and prepare your steeds of war against those who fight you. So obviously, state of war is very clear. There's no question about that. No ideology, no philosophy, no democracy, modern or ancient, worth its salt, would allow any form of injustice to be perpetrated. If injustice is perpetrated and aggression is committed, prepare against them your steed of war. And if they incline to peace, as Brother Joe read after that, then you incline to peace as well. So how can you be inclined to peace if they incline to peace but be at war with everybody else? Please be realistic. I invite you, chapter 8, verse 60, 61 and 62, read it on. And please, you can call me back if you want and see if the reference is correct or not. Now, the question we're really dealing with is hijrah. The next term is hijrah. Hijrah is migration. And migration is a very significant event in Islamic history. This refers to the time around 622 AD when Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and all the prophets before him, had to migrate from Mecca to Medina. Of course, Mecca was his hometown, and he had to migrate to a city called Yathrib, which afterwards was called Madinatun Nabawi or Madinatun Munawwara, city of light or city of the Prophet. And he had to migrate to Medina. And in migrating to Medina, that is called the Hijrah in Arabic. The word migration in Arabic is Hijrah. Now, when you look at the Islamic calendar, Prophet Muhammad did not mark the beginning of the Islamic calendar in his lifetime with that event. It was about 20 years, 15 to 20 years after his after his passing, that we found that the second caliph, Umar, decided, with the consensus of some of the companions, that the migration from Mecca to Medina marked the phase of Muslims being victims of oppression and injustice in Mecca as a minority, to the establishment of an Islamic state in Medina, where the Prophet was in charge and in authority, that as a new phase in the history of Islam, from the old to the new. From the victimized and ostracized and and terrorized in Mecca, to being in authority and in power and manifesting an Islamic order in Medina, that migration should be considered the beginning of the Islamic calendar. And that is why we find now we are in the year 1422. It is the 1422 since the migration of Prophet Muhammad from Mecca to Medina. We're in the final month of that, by the way, and we have a new year coming up, 1423, within the next 2 or 3 weeks. So the migration from Mecca to Medina, though it was a shift of the Muslims from one area to another area, about from Mecca to Medina, city of the Prophet Muhammad's birth, to the place where he eventually moved and spent the last 10 years of his life, and where he eventually died, in Medina, where he lies buried, God bless his noble soul, we find that that hijrah is also the marking of the Islamic calendar. However, note, Prophet Muhammad himself did not consider that migration as the marking or the beginning point of the Islamic calendar. It was done subsequent to that. So hijrah. Hijrah refers to migration. And even Muslims are requested, even in prophetic traditions and so on, that hijrah, there are different levels again, by the way. On the one hand, hijrah means to move from one place where you are ostracized or victimized or victims of oppression to another area. Yes, where there is less oppression or no oppression and so on. For example, the first migration that Muslims undertook, by the way, was not to Medina. There was an migration early in the prophetic mission, when about 3 or 4 years, some say 5 years, after Prophet Muhammad proclaimed prophethood and the message of the Quran and the revelation of God to his people, a group of Muslims, Muslims were persecuted, of course, in Mecca, including Prophet Muhammad. People were killed, by the way. And the first martyr was a lady by the name of Sumayya. And the Muslims then migrated, about 18 of them migrated to Abyssinia, which is present-day Ethiopia. And they were given refuge by a Christian king called Negus, or Najashi in Arabic. And King Negus, a Christian king, then gave refuge to Muslims who were not safe in Mecca. 7 years after giving Muslims refuge, and by the way, Prophet Muhammad was not one of those who went to Abyssinia. It was some of his companions and some of his family members who went, but he himself did not go. But 18 of them found refuge under a just Christian king, and only some of them returned much later when the Prophet migrated from Mecca to Medina, and the Prophet participated in the migration from Mecca to Medina, and that hijrah is the second hijrah, but the one in which Prophet Muhammad took part and migrated himself. But there was a migration before that. Muslims left from Mecca to North Africa, Northeast Africa, in Abyssinia, present-day Ethiopia, where a Christian king, a just Christian king, gave them refuge and safety and security. We have a call on the line. Please go ahead.
Yeah, this is Joe from West Los Angeles again.
Yes, Joe.
You invited me to call back.
Yes, please.
I think that you were trying to present these particular verses as only applying against people who are terrorizing the Muslims. I don't think that's a correct interpretation. Let me read to you from chapter 47, verse 3 and 4. The attack is supposed to be not on people who are attacking the Muslims. Mm-hmm. Rather, the attack is supposed to be very clearly from the Quran against the people who do not believe what the Muslims believe. And let me just please, before you interrupt me, let me read the verse from chapter 47, verse 3 and 4. It says, mm-hmm. That is because those who refuse to believe only follow what is false, but those who believe follow the truth from their Lord, talking about those who believe the Quran. And that is how God gives men precepts of wisdom. So when you clash with the unbelievers, smite their necks until you overpower them, mm-hmm. then hold them in bondage, mm-hmm. then either free them graciously or after taking a ransom until war shall have come to an end. Mm-hmm. That's what it says. It tells them to smite their necks,
yes,
and then take a ransom if possible. Also in chapter 8, verse 12, it says, and the Lord said to the angels, I am with you. Go and strengthen the faithful. I shall fill the hearts of the infidels with terror. Mm-hmm. So smite them on their necks and every joint, and incapacitate them.
Yes.
All right? It does not talk about people who are attacking the Muslims. It is talking about people who believe differently than what the Muslims believe. Those are the infidels. The Quran specifically says that Jews and Christians should be killed, and it specifically
where does it say
says
that, Joe?
Why the Jews and
where
Christians
does it say
should
that,
be killed.
Joe?
Where does it say that?
Okay, it'll take me a few minutes to find that. I can find that for you.
Okay.
It says, in the Quran, it says that Jews should be killed because they believe that Ezra or some prophet is actually God, and Christians should be killed because they put Jesus
Joe,
as a God.
Joe, I challenge you, I beg your indulgence, Joe. Please feel free to call back and find that verse in the Quran. Number one. Number two, could I have a chance to respond maybe to what you are saying there? Yeah, first of all, I think, you know, you are very emotional about this, Brother Joe, and I appreciate your emotionalism somewhat. And secondly, I look at the chapter 47, look at the verses preceding that and after that, by the way, first of all, as you didn't do the first time. Because you need to look at the things in context. I've got scripture here, by the way, I can show you texts. From seven different texts, from different religions, which someone gave to me, by the way, quoting from Bible and from the Talmud and things which I don't believe are necessarily representative of what Christianity or Judaism really in essence is about. But sometimes verses were revealed in a particular context. And you, we have just spoken an hour ago before this with a scholar of Islam who said there's no definitive interpretation and you want to interpret infidels the way you want to, number one. Number two, reread that verse, brother. You reread that verse, not to me, to yourself. And look at chapter 47. And of course, listeners are observing this. They can check the verse whenever they want to. And I'll be online for the next 9 weeks at least. Revelation is revealed, is text. And I think, brother, I really wish you could have listened to the first half of the program. We dealt with this so much in detail. Because I'm repeating myself, to be very frank with you. And you're wasting other people's time, I feel. Not you, myself. The fact that text is revealed in a context. Then, when we understand that in the first place, secondly, it is a revelation came to Prophet Muhammad over 23 years. And it was in a particular context. We have an entire science called Asbabun Nuzul, which deals with the revelation of the Quran and the context of revelation. There are verses which says, and I've quoted some of the verses in detail, which says, fight them and do not stop fighting. But it also need to understand who are the ones we are fighting. Drive them out where they drove you out. Who would you drive out? Those who drove you out. So we need to understand the context of this, first of all. And secondly, I think it's very pompous of you to assume that you are saying, and kill them, and you said them, means Jews and Christians. There's no such verse in the Quran. And the verse about which you are saying, let me just quote the verse for you, by the way. Let me show you that how wrong you are. In chapter 9, وَقَالَتِ الْيَهُودُ عُزَيْرٌ إِبْنُ اللَّهِ وَقَالَتِ النَّصَارَ الْمَسِيحُ إِبْنُ اللَّهِ. This is the saying of the Quran says, some said that Ezra is the son of God. Some Christians says that Jews are, that Jesus is the son of God. This is not the truth according to Muslim belief. It doesn't say anywhere kill them. Chapter 9, check it up. So I mean the idea that you are linking up in an emotional way, and I made it very clear to you, brother, that these verses are very clear, contextual, and by the way, kill them who? Those who are fighting you. There are numerous verses that indicate the entire rules of engagement. You need to understand that. If you want texts, I can quote you 124 texts here from different religious texts, not Islamic, but from direct text, Talmudic and Christian, which is very improper and unprofessional if I were to do that, because these are some texts which may have been in a particular context. Sell your garments and buy a sword. Is that the words of a prince of peace? Jesus was a prince of peace. Context, we need to understand that. So I believe that one of the things that we need to understand, and scholars know this, of Islam and of any other tradition, that when we look at the text in its context. Understand that, and we accept the fact that the beginning of interpretation of human understanding is to understand the context of it. Secondly, if this was the case, there would have been a wholesale slaughter of Christians and Jews, by the way, by Muslims all the time throughout history. Muslims have killed Christians, Muslims have killed Jews, as Christians have had a crusade against Muslims, and as Christians have killed Jews. The Holocaust wasn't done by Muslims for that matter. So anything that's done in the name of religion, abusing text to kill anyone unjustly, I quoted the first verse of the Quran dealing with human value, that if you kill an innocent life in the estimation of God, is the killing of the whole of humanity. That's a general principle. Particular verse, those who fight you, fight them. They try terrorize you, terrorize them. The first verse regarding fighting, I gave a clear indication in the first hour. So I think text and context, Brother Joe, would help us a lot. Not only in the Quran, in others as well. Going back to the term Hijrah. So we said migration, and it also marks the beginning of the Islamic calendar. Not in Prophet Muhammad's time, but subsequent to his time. The next term we're looking at is the term Ibadah. Ibadah is a term which generally used by Muslim people, and is used in the sense of worship, that you worship God.
But the term ibadah has a larger connotation, because when you look at the Quran, you'll find a verse which, for example, says that we have not created human beings except for ibadah. Now, if ibadah was to be deemed only ritual worship, one would assume, of course, that you cannot do anything else but pray. That's not what the Quran intends, nor what it says. The idea of ibadah means that a Muslim is constantly in a state of submission to God. You have faith, you're aware of the fact that God is observing you, the fact that you'll be answerable to God for your deeds, be held individually accountable, and that whatever you do must be done with a clean intention, with good execution, and hopefully with the best outcome and best result. And that's why in Islam we have the idea of what they call niyyah, of intention, that actions are not judged, even prayer or fasting or charity are not judged by the action in themselves, but by the intention and the sincerity that precedes the action. So we need to understand that. So ibadah, though it generally implies worship, but means servitude to God, fulfilling the commands of God, a God-conscious mind that manifests itself in a spirit of goodness and beneficiality to the world around you. As Prophet Muhammad said, that all creation are part of God's dependence, and they depend on God, they're part of God's family, and God loves most those who are most beneficial to His universal family. So ibadah, you'll find sometimes making reference to the word worship, but it means not only ritual worship, though ritual worship is part of ibadah, but of course it means to servitude to the commands of God in general. So even being kind and generous, being charitable, being honest, all this is part of ibadah. Ilm is knowledge, and knowledge is not just the transfer of information or the imbibing of information, but rather the pursuit of truth. For all truth will ultimately lead to the ultimate truth. And therefore the question of ilm, and very much emphasized in Islam, the Prophet himself said, al-ilm wa ibadah. Knowledge itself is ibadah. Every aspect of learning, whether teaching, learning, striving to attain the truth, studying. That's why you find there was never a dichotomy in the early history of Islam between science and faith. We didn't have that kind of clash. Then the idea of imam. Imam is basically a leader. Of course, you know that you don't have a religious hierarchy, nor do you have really clergy in Islam, though we have somewhat established form of priesthood that has evolved somewhat. But in Islam, in reality, there's no such thing as a clergy, really speaking, in the traditional sense. But imam basically means a leader, offering the prize to the person, a learned scholar, who may be a leader in prayer or a leader of the community. And that's why the term imam is used. I'm the director of the Islamic Center of Irvine, and I'm referred to as an imam in that sense. Then you get the word insha'Allah. Insha'Allah is an expression which is very often used by Muslims when they talk and discuss, and it means if God wills. Insha'Allah, if God wills. And it's an expression used for future activity, meaning that I want to do this, I will meet you tomorrow, inshallah, if God wills. In other words, if this is in the scope of what God allows, tomorrow I may not be here. It doesn't mean fate or predestination, that if God wills it, I'll meet you only. No, it doesn't mean that. It implies that within the scope of the nature and of things the way they are, because after all, nature is the will of God in effect. If God wills, in that sense, if I live, if I have the ability, if I'm healthy, you know, by the permission of God, by the will of God. The word jihad, we have dealt with it before, and jihad basically means striving for improvement of the self, striving for improvement of society, or striving for improvement of the social condition which we find ourselves. Jihad, even the term used by our scholar, ijtihad, which is the exercising of the scholarly opinion of human understanding. And then ijtihad, from the same word jihad, striving for something, striving for understanding, and so on. Then we have the Kaaba. The Kaaba is the cube-shaped building, and we saw it very beautifully last week in the ABC production, Michael Wolf, the Hajj itself, the pilgrimage, which is a building which Muslims face, the black building that you see there, which Muslims believe was rebuilt by Abraham and Ishmael, and of course afterwards fell into disuse and abuse, became the center of idolatry, which was in the time of Prophet Muhammad. His own uncles were in charge of the Kaaba, and they were the chiefs of the Quraysh in Mecca, and they were the ones who were the keepers of the Kaaba, and they were the ones who promoted the worship of idols and so on. So the Kaaba, Muslims face it in daily prayer. It's not sacred or holy in itself. It is merely a building, and it's a focus of attention. Wherever Muslims are, we pray in the direction towards that Kaaba, which is in Mecca. But we don't worship it in itself. It's not that at all. So we need to understand the Kaaba. Then we have the word masjid. Masjid is a place of worship. Basically, masjid means a place of prostration. The word sajda in Arabic means prostration. And there we see a beautiful mosque in Hamburg, in Germany, I believe, which you see in the background there. A place of worship, or commonly known in English as a mosque, or a Muslim church for want of a better word, but a place of worship. And by the way, in Islam, you don't require a building to have worship, to pray. You can pray anywhere. Any place that's clean is considered a place of prostration, and hence a masjid, a place of worship. But of course, we have established buildings for various reasons, and it's more comfortable, more appropriate, more conducive. And that's why we have mosques all over the world, of course. We have hundreds of them in America. And please, I would like you to visit them, any one of them, at any time you wish. Because I one problem that I do have with people questioning sometimes is either they go to a text which they have no knowledge of, or secondly, they ask you questions about Islam. They know hundreds of Muslims around them, but they would ask about Islam somewhere in Afghanistan, as if that is the Islam and ours is not the Islam. And then you have to answer for that. It's like asking any European to answer for Slobodan Milosevic, or every Christian to answer for Hitler, or every Jew to answer for Baruch Goldstein, and so on. I think it's, we need to get beyond that. We need to mature beyond that, hopefully. So masjid is a place of worship, and there are, of course, numerous ones. There are mosques. You're welcome to go to anyone at any time. And of course, there are many of them. There are over 60 of them in Southern California alone. Then mimbar. Mimbar is a pulpit in the mosque from which a speaker addresses the congregation. It's a pulpit, elevated place. And this purely is no function except as to maybe be elevated a bit so that people could see you. And in the olden days when there was no microphone and sound system, the voice could be thrown in that way. It could reach a wider audience in that way. Then we have the term minaret. Minaret, a very famous magazine in Southern California, an Islamic magazine printed by the Islamic Center of Southern California in Vermont Avenue in downtown Los Angeles. A national Muslim paper. Minaret is a tower which is attached to a mosque from which prayer is called. So it's a very tall structure which from which the call to prayer originally was given. The minaret is a tall structure, and very, very often we have one that we see there in Egypt, a very ancient one, about a thousand years old perhaps. But there are many, many mosques you'll find they have minarets. Originally, it served the purpose of a caller to prayer going up there and calling from on top to the outside people that it's time for prayer, come to prayer, the time for prayer has arrived. And the person, by the way, who used to call the prayer and still calls a prayer, it's called a muadhin. That's the next term we're looking at. Muadhin is the one who calls people to prayer. And the first person who called the prayer in Islamic history was an Abyssinian, a former Abyssinian slave, an African slave who embraced Islam and went under tremendous torture before being able to embrace Islam. And his name was Bilal. And in South Africa, for example, up till now, we call the caller to prayer, we call the person Bilal. But the muadhin is the one who calls people to prayer. And all over the world, you'll find that, especially in predominantly Muslim countries, or even in rural areas in Africa, and anywhere else in the Middle East or Far East, you'll find that they won't use the mic, but they'll get on to the village mosque and from the minaret, as you can see in the background, the caller to prayer, calling people to prayer, and people respond. The Qibla is the direction of Muslims, that the Muslims face in prayer, as the Qibla. And of course, the Qibla means direction. And of course, Muslims use the compass to find the direction towards the Mecca. We saw earlier on the Kaaba, the cube building towards which you face. So the Qibla is the direction towards that Kaaba. Wherever we are, if you're in South Africa, you face northeast. If you're in India, you face west. If you're in Russia, you face south, for example. America, you face eastwards, and so on. So we find that this is the Qibla. Qibla means the directions that the Muslims face in prayer. And the direction they face in prayer is towards the Kaaba, which is in Mecca. So all Muslims face in that direction. Then we have the term Salah, which we dealt with quite extensively in the second class we had with Imam Sadiq Safir on the fundamentals of faith, what is Islam and who are Muslims. We dealt with the five daily prayers performed at prescribed times. Five daily prayers performed at prescribed times. Muslims perform just before sunrise, just after noon, mid-afternoon, just after sunset, and of course then again later in the evening, anytime hour and a half after sunset, we have the five daily prayer that Muslims perform, and preferably in congregation, but could be performed also at home, congregation in the mosque, congregation at home, or even alone, preferably in congregation. Then we have the idea of shura. And this is supposed to be a mark, according to the Quran, of believers, that they conduct the affairs by mutual consultation. And therefore in Islam too. Even in their verses in the Quran which need to be interpreted, or laws, there are scholars that have views. But they consult one another. And then there's an ijma', a consensus of opinion. Or there's a majority view on the issue. And then scholars would say that. And there would be a debate onto the minority view and the majority view. And this should be understood. This applies to everything in Islamic law virtually. And that, you know, scholars debate and discuss and so on. So shura is consultation. And even general affairs of Muslims, we are requested that one of the mark of believers is they interact by means of mutual, they conduct the affairs by means of mutual consultation. Then we have the question of sunnah. Sunnah means the tradition of prophets. And more specifically, you'll find the sunnah is the documentation of the doings, the sayings, the expressions, the approvals, disapprovals, description of Prophet Muhammad in particular. And prophets in general are seen as models of excellence. And therefore you find in Islam we have the idea that salvation does not lie purely in believing in Muhammad or in Jesus or in Moses, peace be upon all of them, but it lies in being Moses-like, be Jesus-like, be Muhammad-like, do what they would do if they were here in this situation. That is the sunnah, the tradition of the prophets, the way of the prophets. And in Muslim case, very often, example of Prophet Muhammad is more emphasized because we have him as a final messenger, as well as we have a documented tradition of what he did, much of which is authenticated. And therefore, we have a direct source of reference. But sunnah means the style or the way of the prophets. Tawheed, a concept we dealt with also in the second program, a central theme in Islam, referring to the oneness of God, not a numeric one which can be divided or multiplied, but rather an absolute one, God, the first without a beginning, the last without an ending, the idea of one God, but not only one, but absolutely supreme, absolutely unique, you know, in that sense. So Tawheed is a fundamental principle of Islam, a central theme, and the axis around which the entire belief of Islam is based, the idea of one God, and one creation, and God has no one has exclusive rights or access to God. No one is God's people as such. In particular, those who do good, if you have faith and you have a text, Quran, Bible, Torah, and you imbibe those values and you are able to manifest them, God will reward you for the good that you do, the best that you do. So one God, one creation. Then we have the idea of wudu. Wudu is ritual ablution that people do before they pray. It's a ritual cleansing, ablution undertaken before prayer. Then we have zakah, which we dealt with in the second program too, which is a prescribed social welfare text to be distributed amongst the poor and the needy. And finally, we have the term dhikr, which means the remembrance of God, but doesn't only mean saying God's name, which is one way of doing it, but being conscious of God under all circumstances in every way. I wish to conclude by making reference to a Quranic term, or Quranic verses, which will appear on the screen as we conclude. Before I do that, I wish to remind you that please, next week, we most likely will deal with the messenger and the message, Muhammad and the Quran in general, and how that affects Muslim thought and philosophy and civilization, and how it impacted on the rest of the world. But I wish to thank you for being with me, and I leave you with a quotation of the Quran. And the quotation will appear as I read it to you. The quotation says, Quran chapter 58 verse 9, O you who proclaim faith, when you conspire together, conspire not for wrongdoing nor disobedience, rather conspire for righteousness and piety. Keep your duty to Allah. Keep your duty to Allah, unto whom you'll be gathered and who will hold you accountable. I thank you. May the peace and the mercy of God be upon you. This is Sadullah Khan. From Cal State University, Domingo Hills Live, SBS 318, Islamic Culture and Civilization Course, live to you locally on DHTV and globally on the internet. See you next week, same time, same place, same station, same site. Stay cool and keep well, and peace be unto you.